Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We'll fight to the death. We are soldiers. We are soldiers.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network, which you can find by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. That's a great Twitter site, so go ahead and check that out. You'll find myself on there, as well as Mark Prasik, among others. And we'll go straight for tonight, where thank you for coming in, whether you were coming from Blog Talk Radio or listening in through the Bard's Logic Political Talk website, which you can find at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com or some of the other venues that this show is listened to. Now, of course, also I'd like to thank those who would be listening to this on the archives as well. And tonight we are going to cover the State of the Union Address. And we will have some very special guests on this evening, including Virgil Goode from the Constitution Party, who ran for the presidency this past coming 2012 election. And we will also have Randy Stoppelbeam, the National Vice Chairman of the Constitution Party. And we'll also have Mark Willis, who is the Republican Party's National Committeeman from Maine, calling in tonight as well. And of course, we are going to speak with them to get the Republican and Constitution Party responses to President Obama's State of the Union Address. And also, if we have time, I'd like to, for those folks who missed it, play the audio of Rand Paul's Tea Party response that was played late last night. So I'd like to have that for the audience as well if they missed that last night. But I do see a couple of people in on the call already, so I will open up the mics. We have 207. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is Mark.
Okay, great, Mark. And then I also have from the Constitution Party, the National Vice Chairman, Randy Stoppelbeam. I will open up his mic as well. Welcome, Randy. Thanks for coming to the show.
Absolutely. We kind of got done earlier with our version of the real State of the Union, talking with our 2008 vice presidential candidate, Darryl Castle, and had a great conversation there.
Okay, great, awesome. I know, Mark, in our earlier discussion, you know, via Facebook, you said you only had a limited amount of time for us tonight. So, and of course, we'll see how long you can stay as well, Randy. But, of course, it's appreciated for whatever amount of time you gentlemen can stay on. And also, if you can, as I said, Virgil Goode is scheduled to come on as well. And also, there's a possibility of James Smack calling in as well, but we'll have to see if he's going to be able to come away from his schedule to do so. But thank you again, gentlemen, for coming in. So, Mark, overall, what did you think? And then we'll go into some specifics.
Well, overall, you know, it's your typical State of the Union address, and where you don't really remember a whole lot about it after the fact. You have to kind of go back and look at the text the next day or that evening and look at it to see exactly what was said, because with all the applause and it's just, you know, it goes on and monotonous, whether he's talking about the minimum wage, which supposedly was a big surprise last night to a lot of the liberals. That was a hidden secret or something that he was going to bring out or the gun control measures and, you know, those types of things. You know, I sat there and took some notes, and I try to break it down and pull out some, extract some pieces of it, and then go back again and look at the exact text the next day of things that maybe the media is not talking about, or some things he said that, you know, caught my eyes, my ears, that, hey, this is something that they're probably not going to talk about too much. So I'm going to raise a few of those issues tonight, in the next half an hour or so with you, because I think there's some pieces to it that, you know, you're just not hearing about in the mainstream media that are some cause for concern as you look at the text and you go through it. And, you know, again, taking, a few hours after the fact to kind of analyze it and digest it.
Mm-hmm.
You see this as a typical Democrat playbook issue. And in fact, one of the things I heard last night, it's also interesting, you know, after the speech when he walks out and he's shaking hands, kind of listen in on what people are saying to him. Sometimes you can pick up at some things that are interesting. And I don't know who said it, but as he was walking out, there was a lady who said, you know, you are the next FDR. Great job. Something to that effect, you know, with all these broad plans that he had. So I think that's very mm-hmm. telling that when you hear those types of comments, you know, there's no hidden secret where he's going with all this. And, you know, whether he's talking about, you know, rebuilding the roads and, you know, infrastructure, this and that, sounds a lot like the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely hit on a lot of, of course, liberal, you know, agenda type things. Of course, I mean, I wasn't surprised to hear about the raising of the minimum wage. One thing it did kind of catch my ear was tying the minimum wage to the cost of with the cost of living. I found that kind of interesting. And then one thing, I didn't find interesting. I kind of knew he was going to play the heartstrings of folks about what happened to the grade school. And I definitely want to touch on that tonight. Such a big issue that's out there, of course, about the gun control laws and, you know, protection of children, things of that nature. So I definitely want to make sure we touch on those as well.
Yeah, so the first thing I do after these speeches, when you're looking at the text, you know, you might want to take a look and do a search on certain words. How many times did he say the word freedom, constitution, and liberty?
Mm.
Okay, liberty is zero. Constitution once, and that was in the very beginning where he talked about when he cited the quote from John F. Kennedy about mm-hmm. the Constitution basically means that the parties should get together, work together, and, you know, solve problems kind of thing. So that was mentioned once. And then the word freedom was mentioned three times, twice with regards to foreign policy, Aung San Suu Kyi over in Asia, and regarding the defense over in Africa, working with our allies. So, and then the other issue regarding freedom was the right to vote. So really,
right.
only one instance regarding our freedoms was mentioned, the word freedom, once, and that was regarding voting and how people shouldn't have to stand 5, 6, 7 hours in line to vote. So I find it very interesting when you break it down and actually look at the text the next day or that evening, and you look for certain keywords that mean a lot to us. And from our perspective, it is interesting
right.
that those words are very scarce or non-existent at all.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great point to bring out. You know, with that, you know, we've in this being his second term, I think we're going to see, you know, those things missing from this administration, where he's talking less about, you know, us and our freedoms and our liberty, and bring things more towards in a global perspective, you know, talking about other countries as well. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and also, I take it a step further as far as some other things that I heard as well. When you talked about the educational scorecard for colleges,
mm-hmm.
you know, I posted last night on Facebook. I said, hey, you ever heard of U.S. News and World Report, the best colleges in America? You know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need a government scorecard to, tell the parents, you know, which colleges are best. They can do that on their own. We, you know, there are some things we can still do on our own that
right.
we don't have to have the government meddling in every aspect of our life. But I actually went out there.
Preschool. They want to start all the way back at preschool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, look at our education system and how much time is spent and wasted on subjects that are outside of the three R's and the things that we really, really need to get, you know, our education standards up to snuff. And then, you know, even get, when you get to college, I mean, most people will, you know, would agree that do you really have to sit through 60, you know, 2 years, 60 credits of a bunch of classes that you probably don't need just to, you know, crank it out and go for 4 years and get a degree. I think that the education system is so flawed that, you know, I have a law degree from George Mason. I went 4 years part-time at night, but the key courses that I would need to pass the bar exam and be a solid lawyer, you know, even in law school, you're set up to take a lot of courses, and same in college, that you don't really need. It's just part of the overall curriculum. And so I think that's driving a lot of the costs with all this, that, you know, you got students going through taking classes they don't really want to be in. It's not really applicable to their future. And then you're getting into a situation where I saw the other day that all these kids are coming out, almost half of the college graduates are now working in jobs that require a bachelor's degree or less, that basically 37% didn't even need anything past a high school diploma. So you've got these kids coming out of college, you know, with this education system, and whether this educational scorecard or, you know, what mm-hmm. have you, sending kids off to school, coming out, you know, close to $100,000 plus in debt many times, and right. they can't even get a decent job to start paying it off. So there's a lot of economists worried about that's going to be the next crisis that we mm-hmm. face, you know, after housing and all that it's going to be the student loan crisis coming because these poor kids can't pay off their loans.
Well, sure, we've already heard talk about, you know, all those loans being forgiven, and I want to pose this question to you is, you know, he talked about the availability of these federal loans, making them even more available. There are some, and in many ways I agree with this, who say that the ease of the students being able to get these high amount loans is probably, you know, in a lot of ways responsible for the high college costs, because colleges can think, hey, look, we could charge, you know, whatever. These kids would get these, you know, these relatively easy to get loans, you know, to pay for them, you know, these government-backed loans to pay for them. So we'll just, you know, increase our prices because we'll be able to get them because of these federal student loans.
Yeah, it really is a racket because, you know, you hear about big oil and big this and big that, but you never hear about big education. But, you know, it just keeps growing, and the prices keep going up. When do prices go down for education? I'd like to know. And again, I think it's because these kids have to go and stick it out for 4 years to get a bachelor's degree when maybe they could probably get it in two. So you maybe it'll cut the cost in half by just having targeted courses for graduates for things they really need. And if they want to stick around and, you know, take a bunch of other courses and they can pay for it, that's great. But I really think that there's no need for a student to be going to college for 4 years when oftentimes two of those years is just stuck taking a bunch of courses they don't want, but yet now they're on the hook for the rest of their life. They got to pay for it.
And real quick, Mark, we do have a few guests coming in tonight, and I do see 540. I'm going to open up your mic, and then we will defer back to Mark since he does have to, you know, leave in about 20 minutes or so. But of course, Mark, if you could stay later, you're always welcome to. But then we'll defer back to Mark, and then I know we still have Randy on here. We'd like to hear from him as well. 540, your mic is live. Thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you, Robert. This is Virgil Goode.
Oh, Virgil, great. Thank you very much for calling in. Great to hear from you.
Well, glad to be with you for a while. I can't stay too long, but I appreciate talking to you concerning the State of the Union message.
Well, tell you what, since you can't, you know, stay long as well, if you could just give us a few minutes of what you thought in general about the State of the Union the last night, and then we'll bring it back to Mark, and then we'll move over from there. And then, of course, you know, Randy, I haven't forgotten about you. I still see you out there, bud. So go ahead, Virgil.
Well, Robert, his State of the Union really didn't deviate from his course over the last 4 years. more government regulations. I got so tired of hearing investment, which is just a the Democrat word for more taxes, more government spending. And but I'll have to say across the board, I was disappointed in Rubio's response and also disappointed in Rand Paul's. Neither of the three understand the huge problem that massive illegal and legal immigration is causing the United States. It is a big cost. They don't want to address any discretionary spending. For example, I heard that Tom Cole remarked that on a national television show that one of the Republican House leaders, that he thought they'd cut discretionary spending as much as they could. Absolutely wrong. And then when they talk about entitlements, there are no entitlements except Social Security and Medicare. Those are the only two things that's been paid for in advance for many years by many U.S. citizens. And nothing else is an entitlement. You've got to cut discretionary spending significantly. You're never going to balance the budget unless you do it. Obama will never do it. And someone with Obama's philosophy, in my view, is unfit to be president. He is destroying the country. Wants everybody to be dependent on more money, more money. We've got to take care of everyone. Let the government do everything for everyone. It's really destroying America. And when he gets his comprehensive immigration bill through, we're just going to have more people in this country voting for the government to do more, and you will have many more Obamas following Obama. Their name won't be Obama, but they'll have the same socialistic philosophy. And I was very disappointed in the speech and disappointed in the responses.
Well, I'll tell you what, Virgil, real quick, and then I'll open the mic back up to Mark. And now the election's over, I can freely talk about, you know, at least my voting for the, you know, during this past election. Is one of the things you said about immigration that I really liked when you were running for the presidency is that, you know, to put a moratorium on immigration until unemployment rate reached to 5%, you know, below 5%. And I mean, I really, that was one of the best points that you brought up that really pushed me towards, you know, voting for you for, you know, for president. So, you know, and that wasn't the only thing, but that was one of them that really stuck out that really was different than what you were hearing from any of the other candidates. So I think that's a great idea. And I think immigration ought to be addressed, but Mark, while we've got you still here, would you like to respond to anything with what Virgil said on those points?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Virgil's got some good points, especially about you know, maybe put a moratorium on immigration until we get the unemployment number down to something. I mean, and it's you know, around 8 right now, but that's the U3 number. The U6 number that they used to look at is somewhere up in the mid teens, right? So that's more concerning, you know. So if they looked at unemployment today the way they used to back in the 80s and when Reagan came in, the number's a lot higher than what they're telling us. So we have a serious problem with that. I mean, it depends where you live too, and some people are more in tune with the immigration issue. If you live out west, like in Los Angeles, San Diego, you know, hospitals have had to shut down because they can't keep the doors open because and even in Virginia, I've talked to people that, you know, if you've got you know, immigrants who can't speak English very well, or if at all, and every time they get hurt, they call 911. And it's draining our resources and our system in many different ways. And again, it depends on where you live. You know, up here in Maine, not such a big, you know, big issue, but growing up in California, yeah, you know, it is a big issue. And in, you know, the border states, it's a big issue. Another thing I would say is for the immigration issue is you've got to, you know, you got to make it harder for employers to hire these. I mean, we have to go through the e-verify. you know, for all our jobs, and for most a lot of people have to go through that for the most part. And if the incentives aren't here for them to come, then you know, some of them hopefully you know, would be able to self-deport, but that has yet to be seen. I don't know if you know, putting a border fence up is going to do anything. They you know, people can always find a way to dig under it, get around it. You know, so but there has to be you know, the moratorium would affect legal immigration, but it would also you know, I'd like to hear Virgil's take on, you know, but just besides the legal immigration part of it, how would the moratorium, I know it would have some effect. What specifics would Virgil be able to offer to let people know how that moratorium would actually affect illegal immigration? Because I don't think people would really have really, you know, broken that down yet.
Virgil, you have the floor?
Oh, yes. The moratorium would affect legal immigration. Illegal immigration, you've got to have the courage to enforce existing law and involve states and localities instead of having an attorney general like Eric Holder that will go in and fight Arizona, will go in and fight Alabama. They need to be supporting them and supporting cities that want to deal with the massive influx of illegals. It's so sickening to hear Barack Obama say he's for the middle class. He's not. He's bringing in these workers from other countries legally and not doing what he needs to do against illegals that are just illegally here. The only thing they're dealing with is severe misdemeanors and felons, and when they talk about the deportation numbers. And you're not standing up for middle-class United States citizens when you allow so much immigration, and to reward those that have come here illegally with an amnesty. And both the Republicans and Democrats are for it. Some of the big money backers from Silicon Valley, they want more people in here to drive down wages. We need to get wages higher for the middle class, and more immigration doesn't do that. It lowers it. And Sheldon Adelson, who was a big contributor to Newt, and you saw Newt's position waiver on illegal immigration, and then he clammed up Romney. He switched over to Romney after Romney got the nomination, and Romney wouldn't say anything in response to Obama's executive order. He was silent as a clam. And Naya Adelson has contributed to Boehner's pack and Eric Cantor's pack. And the Republicans, they're not going to hold the line against illegal immigration. They're going to give them some type of amnesty, and they are letting the big money control them. And big money wants more people in here to keep wages low. And Adelson, you know, not just him, but a number of the other big contributors. I heard Steve Case this morning. He's for more immigration. We've got people in this country and inner cities that need jobs, that need to be trained instead of bringing in other persons from foreign countries, and that's legal immigration. So both illegal immigration and legal immigration is undercutting the middle class, and if anyone thinks the Republicans, for the most part, are not going to stand up for them, and the Democrats certainly aren't. And I hope the Constitution Party will continue to address the issue. And we need people in this country that will stand up for the average citizens and work for jobs for them instead of trying to just drive down wages but bringing in more people. It's really disheartening. And I appreciate Mark's question, and there are a lot of other issues besides that, but that's one where the Republicans in their response and Obama and his message last night really didn't differ much. And they're both undercutting the average citizen in this country who's paid taxes and lived in this country for decades.
And Mark, if you'd like to respond to that, and Randy, respond to
Virgil's point that the hopes that the Constitution Party will continue to advocate, you know, for those kind of immigration reforms that he was talking about and addressing immigration the way that the Constitution Party has been. So, Mark, go ahead, and then Randy.
Yeah, this is Mark. I can't say I disagree. Both parties don't really want to take a hard stance on immigration. They, to them, it's a hot potato. And, you know, whether it be Rand or Marco Rubio talking about this, you're seeing the Republican Party shift on this. And, you know, I can't say that Virgil has it wrong. He probably has it right. And that's, you know, I'm just one person in the party that the what they're going to do in Congress, I think they probably will end up with some type of comprehensive plan. It's gonna really infuriate a lot of people in the party, you know, the rank and file, the grassroots. But I think it probably will pass something like that. You just kind of see that coming one way or another. And if it is, it's going to happen pretty soon, right? It's going to happen probably next few months. If it is going to happen, so you know, we'll see how that all plays out. If it doesn't happen within a few months, then it may get that can could get kicked down the road even farther.
Mm. So, Randy, your response to what Virgil said on the Constitution Party continuing, you know, to advocate, you know, addressing the immigration issue in the ways that he put forth.
Well, first of all, you know, I heard last night somebody discussing about the immigration problem and the government should just get out of it or something. I don't remember exactly how they said it, but I was like, what? You freaking idiot. You know, it's in the Constitution that Congress has to deal with these issues. And so, you know, as a part of the Constitution, we've got to have people that fully understand, you know, these principles and, you know, how our founding fathers set up our system of government. And it is Americans first, you know, and that's the thing that, you know, when I say Americans first, people like start getting offended, you know. Well, you know what? Go ahead and get offended, because our Constitution is for Americans, not the rest of the world. And those people who come to this country illegally are not covered under the Constitution. The Constitution says, we the people. Well, we the people are the citizens of these United States. And, you know, if you're not a citizen, you're not covered. So, you know, that's the first thing. And, you know, here in Illinois, the Republican Party capitulated strongly. I mean, Mr. Conservative Bill Brady, who ran for governor, you know, I mean, he was Mr. Conservative. Well, he was out there championing the supporting of driver's license for illegal immigrants. And I shouldn't even use the word immigrant. They're not immigrants. If they're here, they're illegal aliens. And so they've actually passed the law here to give illegal aliens driver's license. And the Republican Party supported that, the majority of the conservatives. And so, you know, it's just really bizarre. And a part of that speech last night, it was just absolutely bizarre. You know, talks about wanting to support the middle class and yet wants to have a national pay raise to $9 that's going to cut more jobs. There's going to be more unemployment because companies can't afford to hire more people at that price. So guess what? People are going to get cut. And, you know, this Obamacare is forcing people to no longer have full-time employment. They're cutting them to part-time employment so they don't have to cover the health care costs. So, I mean, it's killing us left and right.
And that's true. One of the things I found interesting last night, and I'll bring this back to Mark, is that, you know, he talks about citizens, and, you know, you brought that up about citizens, Randy, is towards the end of the speech, you know, he was talking about, oh, well, you know, we're citizens and how important it is for us to work together as, you know, citizens, which I find interesting, Obama using those type of terms. Just like there's other terms Obama was using last night, I found interesting. you know, and that was definitely one of them. I'm looking through my notes here to see what I jotted down, some of the other things. It's like, well, where did that come from? You know, when he was talking about, oh, yeah, all of the above plan for energy. I'm like, well, when did Obama start, you know, really thinking about the all of the above strategy? Now, I'm an environmentalist, so I do like the idea of you know, green initiatives. But that being said, I want to bring it back to the citizen.
Well, if I may, just real quick, you asked what the Constitution Party, and I got to tell you, we are working hard to plan for 2014, you know, in all levels of government. We're putting people into positions, and we've got to have people in positions that will stand up for the Constitution, that have the backbone, that won't capitulate, that won't be a part of the Republican and Democrat machinery, forcing them to, you know, acquiesce to these particular votes. And so we've got to fight this from this direction, and that's why I'm strongly, you know, supporting the development of the Constitution Party to answer that very question.
And Mark, you know, if you'd like to, you know, speak on that, or I've got a good question for you, is why do you think that the Republican Party appears to be capitulating on immigration?
Wow. You have a two-hour show, is that right?
yes, but we do go into a third hour.
Yeah, you might need 2 hours to break that one down. And, you know, again, I think it depends what state you come from, you know, and what's going on in your own backyard. You know, whether it's right in center mass of the radar screen or not. You know, up here in Maine, again, it's not such a hot button issue up here in Maine, but down in Texas and Arizona and California and Florida and, you know, the other border states down that way, it's New Mexico, it's probably it's a lot bigger issue. So, but why are they capitulating on it? I don't know. I mean, they signed it. I mean, they back in '86, you know, they granted amnesty to how many millions? So it's been done before. Maybe maybe that the thought is, okay, well, you know, I don't know. I haven't really talked to people up here in Maine. We don't talk about that much. I haven't talked to any Republican leaders down in the southern states. But I'm just wondering, you know, possibly it's been done before. You know, then the world didn't end. People like to solve I'm making quotations with my fingers, you know, solve problems. I think there's a fear that if they don't do that, then they will lose all of them as a voting bloc, and maybe they think that, you know, by doing this, they can salvage a certain percent for the Republican voting bloc, and the Republicans won't get, you know, get it hung around their neck that they were anti. Immigrant. I, you know, all those things play into it. You know, I would just talk to those guys up on the Hill that are really involved in this and get their perspective on it, because it's a little speculation at this point of what's really driving that train, other than, you know, the Republican Party wants to survive, right? That's,
well,
that's good. Part of it. You know, I think that's a big part of it. The Republican Party has lost a lot of memberships. A lot.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this before, you know, coming out of the convention in Tampa and with the elections, the grassroots and the rank and file have left the party for this issue and other issues. They just see the Republican Party capitulating and acting more like Democrats, and they've had enough. So
right.
I can't say I disagree, you know, with the statements that have been made. But I did have some notes here that. About the $9 an hour minimum wage issue, about the raise, and it's, I agree that, you know, that the first thing a business does when they have to cut costs is they cut payroll. You know, and the Democrats, it's amazing that the liberals, and I guess maybe some Republicans too, but mostly the liberals, the Dems, have never realized that they've never gotten that memo. They've never realized that, you know, when you raise the minimum wage, you're going to lose, you know, your businesses will survive. The last thing the business is going to do is shut their doors down and fire themselves. They're gonna let as many people go or to keep a profit, to keep, you know, to stay alive. And the easiest way to do that is to cut payroll. That's always the easiest way in a business to survive. And they've never understood that. And I did hear that. I think it was Virginia. Maybe Virgil would know this. In Virginia, I believe they, because of Obamacare, they've dropped the part-time hours down to 29 hours a week. if it was 30 mm-hmm. hours or more, then they would have to be mandated to provide health insurance. So I heard a story that it's dropped down to 29 hours for
that's
part-time
correct,
workers to avoid that provision.
Yeah, that's so, true, Mark.
Is that correct?
Yeah, they've governor has directed, for example, the community college system, which had a number of persons that were working over 30 hours or more, and so they cut them down to 29, so they would for sure be classified as part-time and not have to provide state health insurance for them.
Wow.
Yeah, the unintended
and you know
consequences
what's bizarre
of
about
these
that?
Laws when they're passed and these policies.
But here's the bizarre side of that. You know, my daughter was just out, doing her income tax. It was informed that if she doesn't have health care, she will have a tax fine against her. So here's a situation where they're forcing people to get put into part-time unemployment or part-time employment and can't get the insurance, but yet fining them when they don't have it. I mean, you know, it's a damned if I do and damned if I don't.
Right, and ultimately what it does is it pushes the organizations, whether public sector, private, and whether, you know, like your daughter, it pushes everybody closer and closer to throwing up their hands and saying, fine, give me the government health care plan that you've yep. been wanting to put us all under for the longest time. I mean, that's the end game with all this, and it's just a matter of getting there. I mean, there's a provision. I don't know if anybody's really looked into this. In 2018, long after Mr. Obama's gone, I don't know if, you know, Robert, if you guys know about the provision, what kicks in 2018, that if you by that point, if you still have a company-sponsored health care plan,
mm-hmm.
Now we're talking 2018 dollars, not 2012, 2013, but 2018 dollars, if your health care plan is valued at $10,200.
I think I know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
In 2018, right? The government under Obamacare, this is, the last big kicker provision that kicks in. There's
mm-hmm.
going to be a 40% tax put on that.
Yep. Yeah, it's going to be added on to some kind of income.
Yes. So that right there will force a lot of companies to just say, forget it. You know, you're on your own. We're going to drop the coverage.
Well, yeah, it's all devised to eventually create a single-payer system.
Right. But I don't know if people realize that's coming, because a lot of people still have, you know, from their employer, pretty decent plans. You know,
mm-hmm.
and $10,200 in 2018, you know, won't be that hard to hit, you know. And that's gonna just really infuriate people when that actually happens. So that's something I'm looking at on the horizon when that kicks in. And I think a lot of people just haven't looked at it that far out. But when that does happen, they'll be like, whoa, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, also talking about shifting gears here a little bit, talking about the State of the Union and all the talk about, with the gun control.
Right.
And using the Sandy Hook incident.
Oh, definitely using that. Mm-hmm.
I think Ted Nugent actually might have had the best response when he said, you know, that it's more of a mental health issue of making sure that we look after and get people, you know, who have, you know, the serious mental illnesses who are doing these acts. It's not the guns. I mean, you can take a loaded gun, stick it on a table, and walk away from it. It's never going to do anything. It's the person that picks up that gun. We all know that. So, you know, looking at it and not having the government, sit there and do all these background checks on all these people, but to have our communities, our families, and people around us, make sure that people who are ill do not get their hands on weapons, on guns, because for all of us law-abiding citizens, you know, there's the word citizen. Actually, Robert, while you were talking, the word citizen was used 8 times in the text. You know, for us law-abiding citizens, there's no reason why my Second Amendment right should be infringed due to the acts of a mad person who goes and kills a bunch of people. And mm-hmm. to take it a step further, Obama, with these, you know, 19, 20-plus executive orders that he's considering passing with regard to the Second Amendment, you know, if he goes ahead and does that, then I know it's been talked about, the articles of impeachment must be drafted at that point, period. They have to be. They have to be. I mean, some people might argue that they should already be drafted, but if he goes ahead and does this, this should be a bipartisan effort to contact your members of Congress and say, start drafting the papers now. Draft those articles of impeachment, because this cannot stand.
I hope there's some member of Congress that would have the courage to not only have an impeachment article drafted, but submit it. And I know the Republican leadership would try to discourage that at every angle. But that's my view, people don't understand, I think, for the most part, how dangerous this thing is of requiring a background check on every gun sale. That means I can't walk out my back door here and to my neighbor who lives down the street who has a gun collection. I can't sell him one of my guns. You will have to go through a dealer. It will cost you. But the worst thing about it is it will give the government a record of every gun sale. The gun show loophole, it's not a gun show loophole. It is to require every private sale. It'll do away with them. The only way you have a sale is you go through a gun dealer. And when the gun dealer makes the check, that is a record. And with someone like Obama in the White House, I would be highly suspicious that information would be immediately destroyed. I doubt if it would. The gun show loophole, the only reason they call it a gun show loophole, if I'm in the parking lot of the gun show and I have a firearm, I can sell that firearm to another private citizen and I don't have to pay a gun dealer to handle the transaction for me. With the so-called closing of that, you can never have a private sale of a firearm to another person. And I think that's an infringement on the Second Amendment. So, it is. That is dangerous stuff to let. I wouldn't want the Obama administration to have a record of every gun sale transaction in the United States. They would know who had every single weapon. And you're approaching then what happened in Germany. That is exactly after the Nazi Party got control. They found out who had all the guns through basically gun registration, and we would be right on the cusp of having that if you do away with the, quote, so-called gun show loophole, because it's not. It's to end private sale of weapons. It would be against the law for me to sell to my neighbor or to sell to a relative, to my sister. She lives in the country. She needs firearms for self-protection. They would want before I could sell or give her a firearm, it would have to be have a background check run, which provides a record.
You know, and none of the things that Obama talked about last night, when he talked about, you know, protecting the children and talking about gun violence, I mean, none of what he brought up really addresses the issue, you know, of the problem of, you know, protecting children or gun violence. And he's just politicizing the issue, of course, using people's emotions on, you know, what happened at the tragedy as a school. What I think would be better solve the problem, at least with the schools and protecting our children. And yeah, you know, this could be. I'm sure they talked about this. Yeah, you know, there's a dog or something in the background. Whoever's got, I don't know who's got that on the
those
mic. Let's find
out. Don't worry, they're fine. They're getting a treat.
There you go. They're getting all excited about that. But you know, the saying is, I'm sure this was mentioned on the Coalition of Freedom show on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm sure Randy, you've probably talked about this as well. But you know, I think a better way of protecting the children, and if folks can chime in on this, is how about not making schools be gun-free zones? I mean, people might be like, "What? You know, allow guns in schools? Well, I tell you what, if you have a, let's say, for instance, for example, a principal, because of their position, one of the things that they have to do is be trained and use and firearms, because you know, if those children are under the stead of that principal, and that principal has to protect the students, you know, protect them against someone coming in the school with a gun, I think would be one way of doing that. Or how about having a volunteer, you know, officer or some kind of armed officer or something of that nature? I mean, we do it on our airplanes, you know, we do it in the stadiums, do it all over the place. Perhaps it's time to start having these guys and gals at our schools to protect our children, instead of saying, hey, look, this is a gun-free zone, so this is an easy target for people who want to, you know, do mass killings, because they know they're going to go into a building that no one else besides themselves is going to have a gun until law enforcement arrives. Now, what do you guys think about that?
You're exactly right. Obama's kids don't need, if you followed his philosophy, he should immediately disarm the Secret Service that are guarding his children, because they're being treated better than the average citizen's child who can't have a who they don't want to have firearm protection in a school. Why do you think the state capitals, all of them are guarded with Capitol Police, and all of them are carrying firearms? If you walk into the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate, they are all heavily armed, guarding those facilities. Why should they get the special treatment? Why can't the average citizen have some sort of protection? It's absurd. It just really infuriates me that Obamanism has brought such special favors to so few.
Yeah, you know, we've certainly gone down this road many times, but, you know, Chicago, what's interesting is in the State of the Union, they pointed out to the couple who lost their daughter who had gone to the inauguration. They live up in Chicago. Guess what? Chicago's a gun-free zone, folks. How could she be killed?
Mm-hmm.
It was a gun-free
right.
zone. How could she be killed by a
right.
gun? It's a gun-free zone. You know, what people don't get is it's not, those gun-free zones aren't working.
Right. Right. I think they're actually, you know, getting the reverse effect. What do you think, Mark?
Right. And on the note of, you know, trying to get this done through the prism of the children, you know, we've seen it in Massachusetts, and we've seen it now with these executive orders that he's been talking about, President Obama. And there's one of them that he wants to clarify through executive order that the Obamacare does not prohibit doctors from asking their patients or even children about guns in their homes, okay? So, you know, unfortunately, the children are being used in cases where they're having cases already where doctors have asked, you know, children, hey, you know, without the parents' permission, you know, how many guns, do you have guns in your house, and how many? And so they're you know, whether that they're coming at through the children that way to find out about guns in our home, or at school, you know, conversely, a gun-free zone, absolutely, you know, those signs should be all taken down, you know, and if the principal or if there's security at bigger schools, they should be able to carry a firearm and you know, whatever they need to be able to protect the children, and like Virgil and, you know, what you guys have said is that, you know, whether it be at the state capitol, you know, we have these areas that are very highly secure, but yet we leave the doors wide open for our children at school, especially now that we know, you know, these types of things are going on. You know, maybe, I don't know if it's any more frequent than it was in the past. It's definitely getting a lot more coverage now in the media than it did before. I mean, it has been happening, you know, for the last few decades. We've had these types of shifts. So, but still, you know, it's not... It's not the it's not the normal average law-abiding, you know, regular gun owner who just suddenly snaps. These people who are doing these acts have some serious mental issues going on, and they're going to make the maximum impact in the least secure area, and unfortunately that's our schools. So I agree. You know, let the principal, you know, carry a firearm. Let certain people at the school, if they're, you know, and if the, you know, I say leave it to the states to figure out. If the state wants to say, okay, you know, Principal Smith, you know, you can carry a, you know, you want to carry a 9 or a 45 or whatever, that's cool, that's fine. But you need to at least, you know, get out there, go to the local shooting range and be able to, you know, demonstrate. A state could very well do that. Say we just basic proficiency, right? You don't want somebody just walking around with a gun who doesn't know how to use it. You definitely want to have, you know, I was in the military, counterintelligence agent for 6 years. I carried a 9mm, and I had to qualify, you know, often just to keep your skill set up. So, you know, and pilots who carry pistols, I believe they have to qualify or at least, you know, show basic proficiency. So I think states might, you know, make that kind of provision. And I don't know if I have a real problem with that. As long as you've got somebody who's competent with a weapon, you're even better off having someone who really feels comfortable, you know, being able to draw that weapon in the amount of time that it would take to actually stop something. You probably would want someone who's, you know, been able to be trained a little bit, you know, more than just you know, someone just grabbing a gun, putting it on their belt. You want to have some proficiency. I think that would be something that people would probably, you know, want to see as well.
Actually, there's a model for that already down. I think it's Harding is the city, the town, the school principal there. For those teachers that have a concealed carry permit and want to carry their weapon at school, they are required to have additional training, and then they are permitted to concealed carry their weapon there on the school property. And so, you know, the thing is, anybody that wants to go in there and perpetrate go shooting, you know, they have no idea what teacher is well armed. And so guess what? They're not going to go to that school. And so the model is already out there.
Well, yeah, I would say, you know, instead of having a gun-free zone, you could put a sign up and say, you know, our principal's packed.
There you go.
You know, you could put signs up there and say, you know, we believe in the Second Amendment, and you are taking your chances, or something like
there
that.
You go.
You could conversely put those types of signs up, letting people know, you know, full well, you know, you're not going to walk out of here,
right?
And get away with it.
Right.
And speaking of weapons, if I'd like to move on to something else that Obama said that kind of I found interesting, you know, coming from his mouth, maybe he's just throwing some platitudes out to people who are concerned about national security. But it was talk about strengthening our missile defense. Virgil, what's your thoughts on that with him, you know, talking about our missile defense, especially with what he did in his first administration, in his first term? Over there, I believe it's in Poland, when he removed our missile shields from that country or somewhere around there?
Well, you know, I think it's typical of Obama. He says often one thing and then does something different. Even many members of Congress don't know what the Intelligence Committee knows and what persons in the executive branch know about the type of defenses that we've got to have. I wasn't on the Intelligence Committee, and so I didn't have the inside knowledge that those persons have. And to really talk, and I mean, a lot of that stuff is classified too. I mean, even if you know it, how much can you say?
True.
You really got to know the threat. Like with North Korea, exactly what do they have? What does our intelligence say? How much does Russia have at this time? What is the true situation in Iran? each of us on this telephone call, like most of the general public, is getting our information from what the media is saying, and a lot of times they don't know the inside scoop, so to speak. So, but I think Obama has shifted and not always done what he said. And maybe some of it, in foreign policy and dealing with our defense, maybe he's gotten some knowledge that he didn't have when he was in the U.S. Senate.
I mean, it sounds like he's sometimes talking out of both of his ends of his mouth. First, on one hand or one side of his mouth, he's talking about lowering the amount of missiles that we have, and then he comes back on the other side of his mouth and talks about strengthening our missile defense.
Yeah, and I myself on lowering the number of missiles we have. Never should that be done unilaterally. You've got to have the players at the table, and you've got to have some sort of inspection that would be such that would be reliable.
And Marv, what's your thoughts on him talking about the missile defense last night? I mean, it was something he said briefly that I jotted down. So
yeah,
I just found it interesting. He brought it up.
It's kind of like Virgil said. There's just some weird things going. So kind of some things going around that it's a little interesting that he says he wants to engage Russia to seek further reductions in the nuclear arsenals and lead the global effort to secure nuclear materials in the event they would fall into the wrong hands.
So basically, he says
we're going to engage Russia. Now there are some interesting things going on with the Russians that really you haven't seen it other than Pravda English. A Business Week talked about it last year as well, about how Russia was going out to Cuba and Vietnam to basically reopen some military, basically military relations between the two between those countries, and using their ports and what have you to allow Russian ships to go in there. And so on the one hand, you've got us saying we're going to engage Russia to seek further reductions and all this. At the same time, you've got Russia very upset because we've talked about shifting our missile defense from into Poland, right? And Russia's saying, why are you doing that? I thought when Bush Jr. back in 2001, 2002 time frame was working with Putin to basically close down the last listening center, electronic center, Lourdes down in Cuba, and that was kind of like one of the last things of the Cold War. They kind of wrapped up, and it was kind of basically an agreement that they had going, and then Putin's saying, you guys kind of went back on your agreement, because now you're talking about moving these missiles over into Europe, and so now we're going to start moving into Cuba and Vietnam. So you've got some weird things going on there where Obama's saying at the same time, we are going to work together to reduce nuclear arsenals. I would basically look at the Pravda English story, and because there are some other things in there, I just don't know how truthful, because it hasn't really come out in any other sources. There's been rumors about, I'll just say rumors, I don't know if there's any truth to it, about Russia actually having a nuclear weapon in Cuba. That came out of Pravda English. Supposedly a quote directly from Putin last year, saying that this is the way the U.S. wants it, they're going to get it this way. So I've been looking for more information on that to see if it's actually true, and it's just there's not a lot out there to really verify it other than what Pravda had put out.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd definitely like to hear more about that. And, if you do hear some more about that, Mark, I'd appreciate if you just send me a message or an email and keep me posted on that, and that could be something we can talk about again at a later time.
Yeah, because I think people should start asking questions. Is this just, Putin, boasting and saying some things, really puffing himself up, Or is there a truth that I just don't know. I wouldn't want to get people alarmed, but it is out there. If you find it, you can Google it. You know, just Pravda English, you know, Putin, Cuba, nuclear weapons. It won't take very far, long to find it. And you know, it is something that I think we should just either find and dismiss, or if there's any truth to it, that's not good.
Definitely. Look into it, folks. Do some research. It's one of the things that we definitely promote here on Bard's Logic, is for folks to go out there and do their own research. Don't always wait or believe everything you hear on the mainstream media and even some of your so-called conservative media outlets as well. So check things out for yourself. So, Virgil, or I see it's about 11 o'clock, top of the hour, and I know you guys stayed longer than what we have had anticipated. Of course, that's well appreciated. If you could stay, great. If you guys have to go, I understand, and thank you very much for coming in. But so we could continue on, or do you guys like to stick on, or whatever you guys want to do?
Well, Robert, I need to leave, but I appreciate your hosting as usual, and thank you very much for this opportunity, and I also want to thank Mark and Randy.
Well, thank you very much, Virgil. It's great hearing from you again, and I hope to hear from you again soon. Take care.
Good to be talking with you sort of on the same team there, Virgil.
Okay, Randy,
and
thank you again for all you did.
Hope to see you in Baltimore.
I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Take care.
And before Mark gets out of here and you make your kind of closing comments with him, I know that Mark tried, ran for the chair, and I want to, commend him for doing so. But I also want to challenge him to, really reconsider that whole Republican thing, given what he saw on the level of corruption and cronyism that's out there, to join with us to help fight this on a different level and perspective.
Well, thanks, Randy, and I'm glad you followed that. It was a very action-packed week, shall I say, and down in Charlotte, and a lot of things going on behind the scenes that some of it came out that people read about. I would say for you and Virgil, to keep doing what you're doing. You guys, I know Virgil was a member of Congress for quite some time, I guess, and he's very independent minded. So I am trying, as I said, I'm staying with the party. I was elected in May of last year, and I'm going to do, it's a 4-year assignment. It's volunteer. You don't get paid, but I'm doing the best I can. I will do the best I can to try to get this party, the Republican Party, in the right direction, and stop the bleeding of the grassroots and the rank and file. And because, let's face it, right now, you've only got the two parties in who are running the show, and the Republicans need to get a backbone and make these tough decisions. I'm going to do everything I can to try to provide some of that backbone, and hopefully bring some people with me in the short term. So that's really, Randy, I appreciate the offer. I am, my concern right now is to save this party, if it's saveable, and if we can do it. And I've signed up for this. I'm going to do it for the next 3.5 years and see how far I can go, and see what we can do to make this a better party. And if the Constitution Party starts winning elections, maybe the Republican Party can take a learn a lesson from the Constitution Party and become more constitutionally minded like we used to be.
Well, no, again, I like to bring in some things from the chat, and thank you, Diane, and of course, and everyone else in the chat who is contributing there. And she puts dare and double dare you, Mark, and I guess there she's talking about you to join up with the Constitution Party, is what Diane's saying. And she says, actually, one party now. I know there's a lot of folks who are talking about the Republican and Democrat Party as one party or a duopoly. As well. So, but I kind of like that. It caught my eye there in the chat, where she said, double dare you. It says, hey, but Glenn Beck is third party now. I'm not a big Glenn Beck fan, actually, but so I used to listen to him a long time ago, but then he got kind of, well, for me at least, I haven't heard lately, but he sounded kind of, got kind of weird to me, but I don't know.
Hey, just one thing I want to throw out there, though. You know, one of the things that you mentioned that you were in the military, I'm a retired Marine, and, you know, there was some, you know, whenever you go out to fight, you want to know what is the measure, what is the level of the success. And, you know, one of the problems with people who say, yeah, I'm going to continue working and doing, and I appreciate that, don't get me wrong, and you are right, we are not at the level where we're winning elections yet, and we could certainly use people like you to help us move into that arena. But the question I have, though, is what is the mark? Where's the line in the sand that will be drawn to say, you know what, I've tried and it's not going to work, and it's time to move on to another direction. That's where we have the problem in the discussion, is where's that demarcation line to say enough's enough and we move on and we say it's time to move a different direction.
Well, Randy, I think that, you know, and Robert, we've talked about the rules that came out of that convention in Tampa. If those rules do not change, if those rules, and Randy, I don't expect you to know the inner workings of the Republican rules that came out of that convention, but
well, I've been watching it, so I understand it.
Yeah, 12 or 40. Basically, you've got a problem, a big problem, where any grassroots rank and file candidate, Ronald Reagan, you know, Rand Paul, Sarah Palin, anybody who would be coming in 2016, who would be considered grassroots or, you know, rank and file conservative coming through, there is a rule right now that cannot be changed until the next convention. It's Rule 40. And it, to me, I always say it's like the generator you hear running off in the distance, but you can't see it, but it's there running and you hear it. It required to be on the ballot at the convention in 2016, the candidate is going to have the majority of delegates from 8 states. And if that doesn't change, it's almost impossible. It used to be a plurality of 5. And Ron Paul had met that threshold in Tampa, and they changed the rule to 8.
Yep.
He had 6 states. So he wasn't on the ballot. Just, you know, for 15 minutes to speak and you know, let the delegates vote. You know, even though Romney had the numbers, he was going to win anyway, but they changed it so Ron Paul couldn't get up there. So in 2012, it was the case of Ron Paul. In 2016, it could be Rand Paul, it could be, you know, Palin, could be anybody who's coming out of the grassroots rank and file perspective. You know, you've got a very, very high bar of 8 states, a majority of 8 states, and it really does favor the establishment candidate through a front-loaded winner-take-all primary system that could be coming. So really what you're looking at is a primary system where you're going to have another establishment-favored candidate coming through and getting those 8 or more states, and a grassroots candidate probably not hitting those 8 states, and the only chance to save it would be to have the Rules Committee at the next convention, about a week before the convention starts, you know, drop that back down, say from 8 to 5 or even lower. But those delegates on that Rules Committee are going to be put there by the establishment candidate who's got all these states. It's almost impossible. And when that reality sets in, Randy, when that reality has set in to people, I'm still fighting to try to change it. We have a meeting in April out in Los Angeles to try to change these rules. I think that line you're talking about, that line of demarcation, that could be the rules. If those rules don't change and go back, if these rules don't get basically wiped out and go back to the 2008 rules, I think for many people that will be that line. They'll say, fine, I'm not going to waste my time. Why would I get involved and do this in 2016 when I know, you know, darn well that any grassroots candidate, it's almost impossible to hit that 8-state mark.
You know, and pass it from the chat.
For you,
I'm sorry, Randy. I just want to bring this up. Tessa in chat brought up. She says, but, you know, even if they change it, I guess they're talking about the party or the people who do the rules in the party. If their chosen one is challenged, they'll just illegally change it back. What's your thoughts on that?
Could you say that again? I was trying to...
Sure. She put in the chat, says, but, you know, even if they change it, I'm guessing they're talking about the Republican Party leadership changing the rules. Let's say, because I know some were talking about changing them back to how they were in 2008. If they're chosen one and it's challenged, I'm guessing she's talking about, I guess, the one that the establishment or whoever is picking to be their chosen one, like Romney was this time around, McCain.
Yeah,
they'll just illegally change them back.
Well, it wouldn't be even illegal. I mean, under the rules, they could. That's the problem, is that you've got, you know, the week going into the election, you would hope that those rules would stay in place and they wouldn't change it, right? But they can. They can change it. The week up to the convention, they can change that Rule 40, for example. They could, let's say, going in, you have a grassroots candidate. Let's say they get rid of the 2012 rules now. They go back to 2008. That's back to five states plurality. You have a grassroots candidate who comes in, meets that threshold. They'll just go, like, I think what she's saying is they'll just go ahead and bump it back up again to eight. That's entirely possible. They already did it before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, yeah, so you're, that's why that rule is so dangerous. That's why that rule is so incredibly dangerous to a grassroots candidate. You really have to. You're just going to have, I think, a national dialogue of the Republican Party. So many people aware of it and potentially outraged at, you know, walking out of the party en masse if they don't allow a grassroots candidate to be on that ballot. So you just got to make the case. But then you say that the bigger problem is, well, If the party is going to fight that hard to keep somebody out, people are saying, why should I be part of the party? You know, why should I even be part of this? If these are the kind of things they do, we just got to try to get as many good people up there to change it. And like I said, 3.5 years, I'll see how far we can go.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you you addressing those comments and questions, things of that nature. And I've got a Facebook. Someone who's posted on Facebook about the show, because they're listening in the show and posting on Facebook and chatting with me there. So it says establishment, and we were talking about the establishment earlier. You cannot reform, this person says, you cannot reform the Republican Party. That is a fact. I mean, and that's just a sentiment. And thank you, FW, for sending that message to me there on Facebook. Which, I mean, that's the sentiment of a lot of things. We've talked about this before, Mark. I think then that's why folks, from like the Constitution Party, they really appreciate your loyalty to the Republican Party. And I think, they really appreciate that and honor that. But also, they'd love to have you aboard, with the Constitution Party, for instance. What do you say to those people, for those who haven't heard you before, talk about that? Because, I mean, I know, and folks can listen to Mark. He's been on the show before, and thanks again for being on those shows as well, Mark, and they can listen to those in the archives. But go ahead.
Okay, so the question got a little muffled towards the Constitution Party to let them know about.
Well, no, the Constitution Party, as I said, they were talking about today, that they very well would like to see you on board with them instead of the Republican Party. I'm sure that, that they honor your loyalty to the party and your hard work and standing behind what you said to do. But, as I said, there's a lot of sentiment out there that, because of the establishment, the Republican Party cannot be reformed, and as I said, you mentioned on how you think it could be, and that's what you're working towards, and you've mentioned that on other shows, but for the benefit of those who have not listened to those yet on the archives, and of course they're welcome to do so, if you could just touch on that a little bit, because
I don't want
to be over redundant for you, because I know you've addressed this before.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of quickly go through you know, when I ran for chair, I put together an 8-point plan of things that I saw wrong with the party, that if we could change some of these things within the party, you know, it would make a really good faith effort to the grassroots and the rank and file members of the party that, hey, this party is going to turn around and change and do things for the better. So there were things such as, you know, number one, well, big thing was the rules. We talked about that forever, getting those rule changed to set up to give a grassroots candidate a chance, just a fighting chance in 2016. But there's other things as well, such as, you know, firing all the consultants at the RNC, you know, drain the swamp, fire all the consultants, and get that money back to the states and give the state parties a lot more autonomy and more power. So I came in with this whole plan, and then there was the technology piece of it, of winning the tech war against the Democrats, of you know, getting the right people hired temporarily to write the algorithms and do the things that they need to do to win. And all these things together, you know, not being afraid to talk about, you know, conservative values and the Constitution and educating. And all these things together, I put together a whole package saying that if you elect me, then these are the things that I want to bring to show good faith that this party can turn itself around. And, you know, it just, you know, I didn't get on the ballot. I didn't get a chance to be elected. It was right. A last minute thing. The grassroots had come to me, and, you know, we had about 3 weeks to pull it off. We made a lot of progress. I mean, it was really amazing. All the hard work. I've never seen people work so hard in their life. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are great. Everybody from, you know, Brian and Michelle here in Maine. You've got Nicole and Chuck down in North Carolina. You know,
right.
I know they've been on your show before. And
mm-hmm.
So you've got some people out there that are really smart, really talented, and really dedicated to, like me, you know, to trying to save this party and get this thing back on the ship on the right course. And we know it's a huge hill to climb. But we're willing to give it, you know, a shot. And goes back to Randy's question again about the line in the sand. At what point do you, you know, you say that's it? Everybody's got, I guess they've got their own line. They'll know, I guess, when the time comes of, okay, I throw my hands up and there's just nothing else I can do. I haven't gotten there yet. So we're doing the best we can with what we've got. And, you know, we'll see what happens out in Los Angeles in April and what comes out of that rules battle and how the dust settles and everything falls out. You know, depending on how things turn out, it could be a bright light beacon going ahead, or it could be, if it doesn't go, you know, very well, some people might say, hey, that's it, I'm done. Yeah, we'll just have to see.
And
just if you mind, I appreciate that perspective, Mark. I do, and that's why I just kind of threw that out as, you know, where is that line in the sand? Because so many people tell me, you know, they want to try it and to do it, and it seems I get that answer ad nauseum, and then, you know, there's never that line. And so just wanted to say I appreciate that perspective, and I just wanted to throw that out to you. Thanks for your graciousness in answering the question.
Oh, sure. No problem. I try to answer every question. It may not be the answer people want to hear, but you know, at least I try to give up.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. Any answer is a good answer instead of dancing around it. And speaking of answering, is, you know, there was, of course, the answering or the response of the, you know, the State of the Union address by Marco Rubio. Mark, if you can, I'm thinking about time, not that you wouldn't be able to, but I don't know what your time looked like. It is, briefly talk about what you thought about Rubio's response last night.
Well, Rubio's response was pretty much, you know, the mainstream Republican response of talking about, you know, helping, you know, protecting Medicare and, you know, coming from a working class background and all that. And he seemed very nervous. It seemed like he was just maybe overly excited.
His mouth was very dry, you could tell.
Yeah,
he had already grabbed that drink, yeah.
Well, you know, it actually turned out to be a pretty big thing up here in Maine because it was Poland Spring that he used. And
there you go.
That's been the buzz up here in the state of Maine. that he gave Poland Spring a lot of free advertising. So, you know, some people, I don't think people were too upset about that. That was pretty interesting when I saw that. I kind of felt bad that, boy, you know, I think everybody's had that moment when they, if you speak, there's a part where you reach for the ball of water. If you're talking long enough, you just don't want it to be on national TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if it's at the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club. It's another thing if you're in front, you know, standing in front of millions of people. I think it was a pretty much baseline Republican response. And, you know, just the kind of the same things I've heard Rubio talk about before, fiscal responsibility, less government is the answer, maybe a little bit, you know, short on specifics. But I think it was his message that he, you know, he's bringing forth the standard message of Boehner and the Republican Party right now that, you know, yeah, okay, we might be able to work together, but we have to hold to what the line of our values and
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, it's pretty much, you know, you're a very typical Republican response. And, you know, other than the water bottle issue, I think he was, you know, he was pretty solid. If you believe, you know, the kind of the baseline Republican that's where you're at, then I think you probably thought he did pretty good, you know. And so I tend to be more of the you know, libertarian Republican. So it wasn't nearly, you know, what I would say, but
mm-hmm.
it's the baseline Republican message, you know, that Obama's spending too much, spending our way isn't the answer. I mean, those are true. I mean, those are good things to talk about. It's just that from my perspective, no one talks about things like, you know, the NDAA and the TSA and all the things that are with our liberties that are being, you know, threatened all the time. We're just not hearing enough of that, saying that there are all those other things that we really need to be talking about if we want to be a free society. I'm just not hearing it.
In the Rand Paul speech, I know they did. I mean, I had actually watched a recording of it because, you know, I was watching CNN, and then they start going to some guy who he was burned down in a, I don't know, so, who knows, they went off to some tangent, and I was like, well, okay, I'm waiting too long to hear the Rand Paul response, the Tea Party response. But I do, and I hope I have some time tonight to play that for the audience, for those who did not get the opportunity to listen to it. But did you get the opportunity to see that? And if so, would you like to respond on that? Or
I just caught part, you know, again, I was, you know, trying to wait. I caught parts of it today that I know he talked about basically people in Congress should be let go if they're not going to follow the Constitution, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I heard that, I'm thinking, well, maybe Rand heard me taking a page out of my playbook when I was talking about fire all the consultants. You know, if you're not doing things the right way, you know, because that's a very popular message right now, whether it be getting the consultants out of the RNC or getting members out of Congress who don't follow what they say they're going to do. You know, and some people say we're really running out of time. You know, I know we're running out of money. You know, we don't have the money. You know, we've got to have people out there with a backbone and a spine. You know, like Randy and Virgil talked about. You know, you've got to take some tough stands. So I didn't get a chance to catch all of it. I did catch that part. So I was like, wow. You know, caught some of the stuff I talked about down in Charlotte. And it's a message that I think is popular with people that, you know, we really got to drain the swamp. And you've just got to bring in new blood, people who are principled and firm with a backbone that will not back down and follow the Constitution, because our loyalty is to the Constitution, not any particular politician. You know, our loyalty is to that document and the founders that created it. And if there's people out there in Washington that believe in that, it's time to go.
Yeah, that's definitely refreshing to hear, because it's about, you know, we the people. But what it seems like is, you know, you may have someone who, you know, you thought, oh my gosh, they're Tea Party folk and, you know, constitutionally minded, but then once they get to Washington, they get squashed because they get in there and they have their ideals and ideas that they want to, you know, to get out there, and yet,
then they get the establishment, you know, when they get to Washington saying, look, if you don't, you know, ride the party line, so to speak, then you just won't get the party funds in order to, you know, run the next time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, and you know, I'm sure Randy will want to chime in on this, too, that like any organization, you spend enough time with any organization and you become part of that organization, you're less likely to rock the boat. You just people get comfortable, they make friends, and they just don't want to rock the boat. And you know, they just, you know, it's a lot easier to go along and get along than to keep constantly challenging. And I think some people may go up there and challenge, and initially, then they get tired of being shot down all the time, and they finally say, well, what's the point? You know,
right.
I like to hear Randy's perspective on that too.
Well, I tell you, actually, the perspective, and I thought it was really fascinating. I was headed up the highway, and I typically don't listen to the talk radio because I get my dander up too high. And if my dander gets up too high while I'm driving down the road, it's probably not good for other motorists. So I try not to listen to talk radio while driving too much. But I was listening to Mark Levin, who was trying to make the case as to why Paul Ryan was a great selection for vice president. Now, he said, but yeah, I understand that Paul Ryan had voted for some bad things. And, you know, and he even brought it back to Rick Santorum. And he basically asked both of these guys, Rick Santorum and Paul Ryan, why they voted for some of these bad things like TARP and these other things. And their response is the response that I think most people just don't understand, specifically with Rick Santorum, who said, the reason I voted the way that I voted was because the Bush administration put so much pressure on us that we had to vote. He said Bush had this agenda that he had to push, and the administration forced us to vote these directions. Now, folks, if you really don't understand what I just said there, is that the Bush administration put pressure onto the senators to vote certain ways. Now, that's contrary to the perspective that our founding fathers had established. So that's the problem with the two-party system, with this establishment. And in fact, you know, we saw the the quote-unquote Tea Party candidates that were elected in 2010, you know, almost without exception, you know, have voted very poorly on some very important constitutional issues. And I would suggest it's because of that pressure that's put on through the administrations, through these top level of these parties, for these senators and these congressmen to vote certain ways. And until we step outside that two-party duopoly, that's the choices. You either vote the way they want you to vote, or you don't get assigned to committees, and you they'll run other establishment candidates against you. And that's just life within the party. And if we don't start changing that dynamic, then we're just going to have to continue sucking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, and this is not a new thing. This is not a new phenomenon. I mean, back in the 50s, there was a Republican senator, Senator Bricker. I don't know if you know, Robert, if you and Randy are aware of Senator Bricker. I think he was from Ohio, I believe. And he was really skeptical of the United Nations. And he was really worried. And I think he had it right, where he talked about the only really bad part of our Constitution, the Achilles heel, was the treaty power. And as, you know, the treaty being the law of the land, once you sign it, good luck at getting out of it, okay?
Right.
So he wanted to push through a constitutional amendment that was going to really, push through the Senate and get out to the states to basically any treaty that was not that fell outside or was not in accordance with the Constitution would be invalid. It was, you know, basically trying to, you know, cut off any more international engagements like the UN, or just basically trying to reel that in because they were so suspicious. And it failed by one vote in the Senate, and it was because Eisenhower personally intervened and got involved, same kind of thing, Randy, got involved and did the arm twisting there with the senators and forced them to vote his way and basically cut Bricker off at the knees.
Yeah, so that's exactly.
It's not a new phenomenon, you know. I mean, Eisenhower's stop it. What does that tell you?
That it's time to get out of that two-party duopoly and start attacking it from the outside.
Well, it's definitely, and that's one of the reasons why I definitely want to have someone to represent the Republican Party and someone to represent the Constitution Party, because I want to have, both take from folks from both parties on the Obama State of the Union address. But I also wanted to, have that kind of dialogue, because there are different perspectives. We're talking about, the Republican Party being part of what some, you call the duopoly, and that's, what we're looking at. And someone from the inside of that, which would, Mark from the Republican Party, and then the perspective of a third party, of someone on the outside of the system looking in and looking at it. Of course, that's you, Randy, from the Constitution Party. But what I am seeing here between both of you folks, and I think this is why, at least in part, that, they opened out, so to speak, a hand to you, Mark, is that I see where you guys have a lot, there's a lot of commonality there.
Yeah, and I think so. I think there's a lot of, if you believe in the Constitution, it doesn't matter if you have an R or a C next to your name, or it's just you really take the time to read the Constitution, understand it, and things like what Bricker was trying to do back in the 50s, to read about those things and learn about these things that have come before. So when Randy says the president personally intervened with Santorum, it's like, well, gee, first thing that comes to mind is Eisenhower and Bricker back in the 50s. And, all those battles go on. But, and a lot of that stuff we'll never know about. It's all done behind closed doors and all that stuff. But so, you've got the two-party system. And I guess the way I'm looking at it right now is I've got to make the most of it. I, like I said before, I just got to try to, see what I can do over the next 3.5 years and see where we're at. And, in 3.5 years, see where things are at, and then reevaluate at that point.
Well, I know for folks, we have talked, on numerous occasions, or at some occasions, about multi-party systems, especially specifically one episode here on Bard's Logic, where people can find in the archives where I interviewed Dr. Timothy White, who is an expert in Irish politics. And, of course, many, if all of you may already know, that they do have a multi-party system. And we did talk about, what some of the benefits of that could be. And is that something that could also be a benefit found here in the United States? And for those who would like to hear more about that, just go, check out the archives where we're talking about multi-party systems. So I just wanted to be honest, give a shameless plug for an episode for people to check out in the archives. But and speaking of shameless plugs, I would like to give both you gentlemen an opportunity, if there are any kind of websites or links or Facebook pages or things of that nature, or shows that you guys would like to give a plug for, while we go ahead and use that as a segue to do so. So go ahead, Mark, and then Randy.
Okay, well, you can find me on Facebook, a couple of sites. There's just Mark Willis, National Committee Man. Let me pull up here real quick. Main Republican Party, I believe. Yeah, Mark Willis, Main Republican National Committee Man. So if you go to Facebook, type in Mark Willis, Main Republican, you'll find that. There's the site Mark Willis for RNC Chair. That is the grassroots site they put together. Lots of good information in case, someone's listening who didn't really follow it or would like to know more about it. The site's still up on Facebook. They could take a look. And, then you guys can contact me through that way. I know, Robert, you use the Republican National Committee Man site to ping me with questions. So I would say just go to Facebook and find me there. I have a Twitter account. It's Willis NCM. But I don't tweet that often. I really don't do a whole lot on Twitter. But I do have an account. I just like Ashley Ryan is our she's our youngest member ever in the RNC. She's 21. I mean she makes me look I feel like I'm walking around with a cane. The way she texts with Twitter and everything with her phone and just these have, you know, well, young lady in her case, or these, you know, the younger people, they're so, I'm just like, oh my God, how do you do it so fast? But, you know, so I'll text and tweet sometimes, but not like the younger generation. I'm 43, you know, kind of seen as one of the elder statesmen of the Liberty Movement here in Maine. We got a lot of great young people in their 20s and 30s coming up who I'm looking forward to working with in the future too. So, you know, really, really good people. So, you know, you may want to have Ashley on your show sometime too. For the next generation coming up.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. And Randy, if you'd like to go ahead, and you have a few pages and a Blog Talk Radio show yourself, so let's talk about that.
Well, thank you, Robert. I appreciate it. And it's good to talk with you, Mark. I listened to the show that they did interviewing you before you were heading there for your run there for the chair. And so I am somewhat familiar with what you've been doing, and so I just wanted to commend you again. I got, as Robert said, I have another blog. I have a Blog Talk Radio show myself, Constitutionally Correct, and every Wednesday we do Constitution Party Talk Radio, where I just interviewed our 2008 vice presidential candidate, Darrell Castle, and talked about the State of the Union there. I also have a website, constitutionallycorrect.org, where I try to provide some resources and teaching and some collaboration there on the issues of the Constitution. And, of course, I'm the national vice chairman of the Constitution Party, and so constitutionparty.com if you want to learn more about you know, taking a look at what we can do for 2014 and, of course, looking towards 2016. So thanks a lot, Robert.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you both, you gentlemen, for coming on the show and talking about the Obama State of the Union address. And we do have about 24 minutes of lifetime left, so Mark, as I said, thank you for your extended time staying tonight, as well as for Virgil staying as long as you did as well, and then, of course, you, Randy, and for the other times you gentlemen have come on. So we can continue on with covering the State of the Union, or if either of you gentlemen need to go with some party words, let's take that time for now, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, well, this is Mark. I actually need to, I need to get going. I was supposed to get going about an hour ago, but
yes, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's fine. It went by really fast, so an hour and a half. Wow. Yeah, so parting words. I'm, you know, I don't know what else to say. I think we covered a lot tonight.
Mm-hmm.
State of the Union's a lot of clapping, a lot of things are said, but they're not really that memorable. So, you know, you go back and you listen to what you can at the time, and you go back and look at the text. And I would just tell people, you know, who are listening, that, you know, from this point on, one thing you might want to keep in mind watch it on TV. Listen for keywords like liberty, constitution, freedom, and in the case of, like you mentioned, citizen was mentioned 8 times. You know, liberty was mentioned 0 times, constitution once, and freedom 3 times. So it is interesting the language that they use. So I would focus on keywords to see, you know, what are they talking about and what are they not talking about, and then try to find those things in that State of the Union speech that maybe the mainstream media is not talking about, and wonder why, you know, like this education scorecard that they came out with. You know, U.S. Mm-hmm. World Report comes out with their top colleges every year. I'd like to know how much money was spent on this education scorecard website and the team to put it together. How much money did they waste on putting this together when there's already something out there, you know? This is the kind of stuff that is just, you know, I don't know. I mean, was it, you know, $100,000 or $1 million? I mean, who knows how much money it was. But these are the types of things that we just need to stop funding. We don't need this. It's not the government's job to tell parents, oh, this college is better than this one. Let the parents, we're still free people, at least, you know, somewhat. You know, come on. We have to you know, be able to decide these things for ourselves. You know, and again, you know, with Obama, you know, having so many friends in academia, you know, who's to say this education scorecard isn't biased and slanted towards, you know, different schools of their choice. So those are things that really bother me when I hear things like that coming out. We already have something in the private sector, a magazine, an established business that puts this stuff out, and now you're competing with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that really bothers me. And then we talked about the guns, and you know, I was right. It was Virginia where they dropped it down from 30 hours, you know, or more to 29 to avoid the Obamacare healthcare provisions. And you're going to see these things happen in America that to get around these laws. And it kind of concerns me. You know, when I was a soldier back in the 90s in Germany, I sat down in a bar. I just got in the country there, and I was in a bar with an old German guy, and his English was okay. And he was telling me that he says, I know you think that the national sport in Germany is soccer or football. He says, no, it's tax evasion. He said, that's the number one sport. You know, the Germans have tens of thousands of marks tucked away that they'll never know about because we've mastered the art of tax evasion. So they, you know, for all the laws and regulations that were coming through Germany, they were still finding ways to get around it. Human beings will always find ways to get around these things. If, you know, we're just people, even in a society like Germany that's far more submissive to the government, they still find ways around it, and they don't tolerate all that either. So it's interesting to see, you know, what's going to happen here with Obamacare and how people find their way around it. But when I see things like this, what's happening in Virginia with the 29-hour provision, that just tells me right there they're going to find ways around it. And these are the unintended consequences of the eggheads up there in D.C. that think they've got it all figured out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And who is it going to hurt? Who is it going to hurt the most? And it's going to be we the people. They say they're fighting for the middle class, they're fighting for the citizens of America, but actions speak louder than words. We've all heard that saying before. And, you know, there's only going to be so long where people could be, you know, convinced that what they're doing is the right thing for the people.
Yeah, and in reason, you know, asking to have the minimum wage raised to $9 an hour. And here's another thing I wanted to mention earlier. The Democrats always talk as if you're going to have, you know, a one or two people in a household making minimum wage as if they'll never move up and out. You know, that they're always going to be stuck at that wage. When you hear them talk about it, the storyline that they make is that, oh, these, you know, they're below the poverty line. Well, you know, minimum wage, I got paid that in high school and, you know, working my way through college. But, you know, you don't stay at minimum wage jobs, you know, forever. It's just, those are jobs that you use to learn skills and move on and, you know, graduate up with the work chain. So,
right.
But the narrative, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the narrative that they come out with is that they make it sound as if you're, you know, boy, you're never going to get past $9 an hour, so you better take it. And, you know, because they're not going to make it past $9 an hour, then we've got to have all these other things to make it fair and equitable across the board. It's totally disingenuous. And like Randy and Virgil had said, you know, what's going to happen? It's going to damage workers, the middle class, the most, because people are going to have to be let go. You know, the payroll
right.
is the first thing that's going to be cut, and people are going to have to be let go. And, you know, it's just the cost of doing business. The business has to make a profit and has to survive, and they still haven't figured this out.
Yeah, well, because, you know, they're using the politics of emotions, and they're trying to pull on people's heartstrings. I mean, they're trying to do out the gun laws. You know, they're trying to use this for, you know, $9 an hour minimum wage. And, of course, then they're, you know, trying to say, oh, well, we'll tie it to the cost of living and, you know, things of that nature. You know, and that's just a ploy, you know. And that's why, yet another reason why we see, you know, people to, you know, instead of just watching, you know, the mainstream media and even some of the so-called
conservative media is to, you know, do your own research and find out, you know, things for yourself and listen to shows like, you know, okay, shameless plug again, Broadest Logic Political Talk, and also listen to Constitutionally Correct and, you know, check out web pages such as yours, Mark, and, you know, things of that nature. So,
yeah. Well, Robert and Randy, I'm gonna head out and you know, get a few more things going here that I have to take care of, and then catch some disease and get up early and do it all over again.
No problem. Well, thanks again for coming in, Mark. We really appreciate all the time that you spent with us this evening, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Yep, you too, and Randy, nice to meet you, and good talking to you, and. You know, even if you are a Marine, you know, hey. No, I'm just kidding. There's an old joke, right? The Marines know how to fight, kill, and win, and the Army just knows how to die. You know, that I used to get that all the time from my Marine friends.
So, oh my gosh!
Yeah.
it's good to talk with you, Mark, and you know, I'll be watching for you, brother. When I start seeing that line, I'm like, it's time for you to make a reconsideration now.
That works, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
No, I'm just gonna head out and say, you know, good night to everybody, and you know, I guess I'm sure we'll talk again.
All right, we will. Take care.
All right, guys. Bye bye.
All right, good night. And, thank you, Randy. Now, have you heard the Rand Paul's response at all, Randy?
No, I've not had the opportunity to hear that. I've been so, you know, concentrating on getting my show ready and stuff, and then
sure, no,
here,
I understand
so,
that.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
Okay, well, one of the things I did kind of promise to folks, but this will take us pretty close to the recording time. So what I'd like to do before I play his response, it's about 13 minutes, but it's interesting stuff, even though some of the stuff we could tell, there's platitudes thrown in there. But if you'd like to call in to listen to the extended version, we'll see how far we get into that. Could be 5 minutes, could be 59, we'll see. But the call-in number to listen or to chime in by pushing 1 on the number dial is 347-945-7428. And, of course, you're more than welcome to call in just to listen or to chime in and be heard. But if we do not get to the, and I don't think we will, get through the Rand Paul response before the end of the lifetime. So all those who will not call in, thank you very much for listening to the show, and whatever you miss after the live section, it will be recorded, and you can find that on the archive. So thank you very much. Take care, and have a good night. And we look forward for you to come on to the show again. And so at this time, we will begin the Rand Paul's Tea Party response to the State of the Union Address.
It's exceptional because we're founded upon the notion that anyone, in fact, everyone, should be free to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. You know, for the first time in history, men and women were guaranteed in America a chance to succeed based not on who your parents were, but on your own initiative and your desire to work. We're in danger, though, of forgetting what made us great. The president seems to think the country can continue to borrow $50,000 every second. The president believes that if we can just squeeze more money out of those who are working, I don't think it'll work. The path we are on is not sustainable, but few in Congress or in this administration seem to recognize that their actions are endangering the prosperity of this great nation. Ronald Reagan said, "Government is not the answer to the problem. Government is the problem." Tonight, the president told the nation he disagrees. President Obama believes the government is the solution. More government, more taxes, more debt. What the president fails to grasp is that the American system that rewards hard work is what made America so prosperous. What America needs is not Robin Hood, but Adam Smith. In the year we won our independence, Adam Smith described what creates the wealth of nations. He described a limited government that largely did not interfere with individuals and their pursuit of happiness. All that we are, all that we wish to be, is now threatened by the notion that you can have something for nothing, that you can have your cake and eat it too, that you can spend $1 trillion every year that you don't have. I was elected to the Senate in 2010 by people who were worried about their country, worried about their kids, and worried about their future. I thought I knew how bad it was until I got here. It's worse than I could have ever imagined. Congress is debating the wrong things. Every debate in Washington is about how much to increase spending, a little or a lot. How much to increase taxes, a little or a lot. The president does this big, oh, woe is me, over the $1.2 trillion sequester cuts in spending that he endorsed and he signed into law. Some Republicans are now joining him. Few people understand that the sequester doesn't even cut any spending. It just slows the rate of growth. Even with the sequester, if it goes through, government will grow over $7 trillion over the next decade. Only in Washington could an increase in $7 trillion in spending over a decade be called a cut. So what is the president's answer? Over the past 4 years, he has added over $6 trillion in new debt and may well do the same in a second term. What solutions does he offer? He takes entitlement reform off the table and seeks to squeeze more money out of the private sector. He says he wants a balanced approach. What the country really needs is a balanced budget. Washington acts in a way that your family never could. They spend money they don't have. They borrow from future generations. And then they blame each other for never fixing the problem. Tonight I urge you to demand a new course. Demand Washington change their ways or be sent home. To begin with, we absolutely must pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The amendment must include strict tax and spending limitations. Liberals complain that the budget can't be balanced, but if you cut just one penny from each dollar we currently spend, the budget would balance within 6 or 7 years. The penny plan has been crafted into a bill that millions of conservatives across the country support. It is often said there's not enough bipartisanship up here. That's not true. In fact, there's plenty of bipartisanship. Both parties have been guilty of spending too much, of protecting their sacred cows, of backroom deals in which everyone up here wins, but every taxpayer loses. It's time for a new bipartisan consensus. It's time Democrats admit that not every dollar spent on domestic programs is sacred, and it's time Republicans, myself included, realize that military spending is not immune to waste and fraud. Where would we cut spending? Well, let's start with ending all foreign aid to countries that are burning our flag and chanting death to America. In addition, the president could begin by stopping selling or giving F-16s and Abrams tanks to Islamic radicals in Egypt. Not only should the sequester stand, many pundits say the sequester's far short, that we need $4 trillion in cuts. If you were to freeze spending, it would actually be called $9 trillion in Washington. If we don't, we're in danger of having our credit rating downgraded. Now, both parties will have to agree to cut. We have to work together, or we'll never fix our fiscal mess. Bipartisanship is not what is missing in Washington. Common sense is. Trillion-dollar deficits hurt us all. Printing more money just feeds the never-ending appetite for spending, and it hurts us all. We pay higher prices every time we go to the supermarket or the gas pump. The value of the dollar shrinks with each new day. Contrary to what the president claims, big government and debt are not a friend to the poor and the elderly. Big government debt keeps the poor poor and saps the savings of the elderly. This massive expansion of debt destroys savings and steals the value of your wages. Big government makes it more expensive to put food on the table. Big government's not your friend. The president offers you free stuff, but his policies keep you poor. Under President Obama, the ranks of America's poor have swelled to almost 1 in 6 people. We are now at an all-time high in long-term unemployment. Millions of Americans are struggling and out of work. The cycle must be broken. The willpower to do this will not come from Congress. I've seen how they act. It must come from the American people. Next month, I'll propose a 5-year balanced budget. A budget that last year was endorsed by taxpayer groups across the country for its boldness and for actually solving the problem. I will work with anyone on either side of the aisle who wants to cut spending. But in recent years, there's been nobody to work with. The president's passed massive tax hikes and spending increases. And you know how many people he gets to vote for his budget? Zero. Nobody voted for his budget. Not a single Democrat voted for the president's budget. How's that for leadership? But at least he tried. Senate Democrats have not even produced a budget in the entire time that I've been in office. It's just shameful. It's a display of incompetence that illustrates their lack of seriousness. This year, they say they'll have a budget, but after just raising taxes by hundreds of billions of dollars, they now say that their budget's going to include more tax hikes. The president tonight said he wants to squeeze more money out of folks. We must stand firm. We must say no to any more tax hikes. Only through lower taxes, less regulation, and more freedom will the economy begin to grow again. Our party is the party of growth, jobs, and prosperity, and we will boldly lead on these issues. Under the Obama economy, 12 million people are out of work. During the president's first term, 800,000 construction workers lost their jobs, and another 800,000 simply gave up looking for work. With my five-year budget, millions of jobs would be created by cutting the corporate tax, cutting the corporate income tax in half, by creating a flat personal income tax of 17%, and by cutting the regulations that are strangling American businesses. The only stimulus ever proven to work is leaving more money in the hands of those who earned it. For those who are struggling, we want you to have something infinitely more valuable than a free phone. We want you to have a job and a pathway to success. We're the party that embraces hard work and ingenuity. Therefore, we must be the party that embraces the immigrant who wants to come to America for a better future. We must be the party who sees immigrants as assets, not liabilities. We must be the party that says, if you want to work, if you want to be an American, we welcome you. For those striving to climb the ladder of success, we must fix our schools. America's educational system is leaving behind anyone who starts with disadvantages. We've cut classroom sizes in half, we've tripled spending on education, and still we lag behind much of the world. A great education needs to be available for everyone, whether you live on Country Club Lane or in government housing. This will only happen when we allow school choice for everyone, rich or poor, white, brown, or black, everyone. Let the taxes you pay for education follow each and every student to the school of their choice. Competition has made America the richest nation in history. Competition can make our educational system the envy of the world. The status quo traps poor kids in a crumbling system of hopelessness. When every child can, like the president's kids, go to the school of their choice, then the dreams of our children will come true. Washington could also use a good dose of transparency, which is why we should fight back against middle-of-the-night deals that end with massive bills that no one has read. We must continue to fight for legislation that forces Congress to read the bills. For goodness sakes, at least read the bills. We must continue to object when Congress sticks special interest riders on bills in the middle of the night. And if Congress refuses to obey its own rules, if Congress refuses to pass a budget, if Congress refuses to read the bills, then I say, sweep the place clean, limit their terms, and send them home. I've seen the inner sanctum of Congress, and believe me, there is no monopoly on knowledge there. If they won't listen, if they will not balance the budget, then we should limit their terms. We're the party that adheres to the Constitution, and so we won't let the liberals tread on the Second Amendment. We will fight to defend the entire Bill of Rights, from the right to trial by jury to the right to be free from unlawful searches. We will stand up against excessive government power wherever we see it. We cannot and will not allow any president to act as if he were a king. We will not let any president use executive orders to impinge on the Second Amendment. We won't tolerate secret lists of American citizens who can be killed without a trial. Montesquieu wrote that there can be no liberty when the executive branch and the legislative branch are combined. separation of powers is a bedrock principle of our Constitution. We took the president to court over his unconstitutional recess appointments and won. If necessary, we will take him to court again if he attempts to legislate by executive order. Congress must reassert its authority as the protector of these rights, stand up for them, no matter which party is in power. Whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, I will oppose abuses of power by the executive. Congress must stand as a check to the power of the executive, and it must stand, as it was intended, as the voice of the people. The people are crying out for change. They're asking for us to hear their voices, to fix our broken system, to work together, to right our economy, and to restore their liberty. Let us tonight let them know that we hear their voices, that we can and must work together, that we can and must rechart our course towards a better future. America has much greatness left in her. We will begin to thrive again when we begin to believe in ourselves again, when we regain our respect for our founding documents, when we balance our budget, when we understand that capitalism and free markets and free individuals are what creates our nation's prosperity. Thank you, and God bless America.
There you go, folks. There you go, Randy. You heard his response. What's your thoughts?
Well, I know that this is going to hack a lot of people off, and they're going to say I'm a loony. But there's a lot of what he has to say that causes me to believe he's just an establishment Republican. He talks a little bit about the stat. You know, he certainly got some of the speaking points from his father, but he is anything but his father, Ron Paul, in terms of the constitutional principles that are mandatory. You know, and he uses terms like when he talked about immigrants being an asset. That mm-hmm. is a globalist term. They look because the globalist bankers that the system out there looks at, and this is how they look at debt. They look at each person born in the United States as an asset to pay back the debt. And so mm-hmm. start understanding the terms that are being used out there, you know, and I got to tell you, this idea of a balanced budget amendment, while it sounds great, I would just love to be able to force Congress and our United States government to have a balanced budget. But guess what? We have a constitutional mandate here in the state of Illinois to have a balanced budget. When is the last time do you think that Illinois had a balanced budget? Okay, so it's a farce. It's just a red herring to throw out there to sound like, yeah, I'm for a balanced budget. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, it's just another law that they just will ignore and give no credence to. So they can talk about it till they're blue in the face. It's never going to happen, and even if it did, they're not going to abide by it any more than the state of Illinois abides by the Constitution that mandates a balanced budget. Here, there's actually an article within our Constitution here in the state of Illinois that mandates a balanced budget. And I'm telling you, I don't know of a time in Illinois' history that they actually had a balanced budget. I suppose there was, but I don't know of one. And
wow.
The other thing is the issues of education. The you know, the Department of Education for the federal government blows more money than any good they ever do with it. So to talk about the Department of Education having any credence at the federal level is a farce. And they, you know, the idea that they're going to have this scorecard now. I mean, you know, I talked to school administration after school administration who talked about, you mm-hmm. know, like No Child Left Behind stuff, you know, that caused more unfunded mandates than anything. And so it's to take a look at it here in the state of Illinois, the Department of Education, they brought – now, here's the thing. They brought in – the lottery, state lottery in the state of Illinois to, quote, mm-hmm. unquote, subsidize education. So
right,
now
they did that in Ohio, too.
What's that?
Yeah, they did something like that in Ohio, too. Yeah. That's kind of a big push in Ohio about the lottery, saying the schools would get a good part. But while I've got the mic here, I do see some folks in the switchboard. So if any of you folks would like to chime in, just go ahead and push the one on your number dial, or the one number on your phone dial, if you'd like to chime in. Go ahead, Randy. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. Rand Paul is talking a good game out there, and certainly of the senators, he's probably one of the better ones. But I'm just saying this to show that there's the establishment out there that we have to understand the language that's being used. We have to understand what's really being said out there, and realize that these responses is just more Republican machinery responses to the whole thing. I mean, you know, one of the things that was mentioned about Rubio was the fact, you know, that here's a guy who's talking about the need to change it, but he was a recipient of, you know, $100,000 in grants and stuff for his education. And so, you know, at some point in time, you got to say, look, you know, if you really can't be serious if you're going to capitalize and manipulate the system. So, you know, those are just some thoughts that I have. Now, certainly, like I say, Rand Paul is probably one of the better senators that's in the Senate right now. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's just reflecting more of the Republicanism that's damning this country just as much as the Democrats almost.
Right, yeah, and there has been, you know, some talk about the Tea Party folks' displeasure with Rand Paul, and here Mary Scott posted on Facebook on the show's what do they call it? Not a link, but it's a thread. That's it. Brain freeze there for a second. There's a thread for the show on Facebook. And thank you for your post to Mary Scott, where she says that, you know, some people are saying online that they didn't like Rand Paul being called the voice of the Tea Party because they said he doesn't speak for them, and they don't like him because they think he's really a libertarian. And then some I've heard very often say that he sides with the establishment too much for their liking.
Well, look, I mean, come on. I mean, you know, if he was more libertarian, I'd probably like him a little better. But the fact that he endorsed Romney, I mean,
right.
you know, it's like here in 2006 when I ran for governor, and I mentioned this guy's name, Bill Brady, who supported illegal aliens getting driver's license in the state of Illinois. You know, he was almost, there was a point in time I'm like, man, this guy is almost more conservative than I am. Because I was new to the game, I didn't understand some of the things, and man, you know, I had a good, healthy respect for this guy. I'm thinking, man, if he wins the nomination for Republican for governor, I might drop out in deference to him. And then when he lost the race, he not only supported but endorsed Judy Bar Topinka, who was even more left of the Democrat candidate, and you'll recognize his name, Rod Blagojevich. She was left of Rod Blagojevich in most of her social positions and stances. And this guy endorsed her. So it's not a matter of will they sacrifice their principles. It's not an if. It's a matter of when they feel it politically expedient to do so. And that's what I see with Rand Paul is it's not a matter of if. He's already demonstrated he will sacrifice those principles when he finds it politically expedient to do so, like he did with endorsing Romney.
Yeah, I know that made a lot of folks upset, you know, especially the Ron Paul supporters, about Rand Paul endorsing him. Some are saying that he, you know, it was a half, I'm going to say this, but a half-assed, you know,
endorsement of them, because it really, I mean, when you really look at the anatomy, as Mark Prasik would say, the anatomy of an endorsement, it really didn't fit a lot of the criteria. But that being said, he still did come on and throw his support for Romney, which, you know, it was still there, regardless of how lackluster the endorsement was. But, yeah, I believe that he was like, well, okay, if he's going to be a part of the party, if he's not going to be totally shut out like his father, and frankly, in a lot of ways, when Newt Gingrich was running for the nomination, he was, you know, really shut out too. And I find it interesting that, of course, once he did suspend his campaign, he got more airtime, as it were, and speaking time than he did when he was running. And much of that was because of, not just because of the Republican Party, but a lot of your so-called conservative news outlets as well. So, but yeah, but I think that was the case.
Yeah, and you know, look, his dad was running for president, and he endorses Romney. So, you know, that's got to tell you something about political expediency. We talked earlier about Rick Santorum voting for some horrible things because of the pressure put on him. And so that's why, you know, the State of the Union, and then, you know, hearing what Obama's position is, and then to hear these Republicans espouse their positions, it's not that much different. You know, they want to talk about curtailing spending and all these other things. But, you know, let's face it, the Republican Party has been in power in both houses, and we didn't see Roe v. Wade overturned, and, you know, we didn't see the deficit cut. You know, we saw great expansions during those times. So, you know, it's just all smoke and screen and red herrings, and at some point in time, I just pray that people will start waking up to realize it.
Yeah, but two things. I think, you know, somebody here on Facebook asking, or bringing up Rand Paul's conservative voting record. I can't, you know, say that I know all of, you know, Rand Paul's voting record. So I don't know if it indeed is, you know, 100% conservative. Because frankly, to be honest, I mean, a lot of folks might not like this, but I really don't follow Rand Paul all that closely. At least at this time, I do not. What do you say on that?
You know, that part is a good point in terms of some votes, and that's probably one of the things that I don't follow as closely as I ought to is the voting records of all of these individuals. Now, there was some aspect that I remember that Rand Paul, one of his votes was very contrary to the ideas of liberty, and I don't remember which particular one that was, but so, you know, they might have a point, and I couldn't argue it because I'm not real well aware of what the voting records are, and I probably should be.
Well, yeah, in that case, the same, you know, for myself. That's why I don't speak as much on it. But I do know that, you know, about the endorsement. And then even, you know, with his speech and, you know, with the Tea Party, you know, I mean, I guess the jury is still out for a lot of folks on whether – I mean, some love him, some think he's disingenuous. I mean, really, the jury's kind of out on that because, I mean, when you talk about Rubio, being conservative, or even Ryan being a conservative, I think the jury's already came in. They're not so much. You know, probably Rhino and conservative clothing, so to speak. Or Rhino and elephant clothing. I don't know how you – someone would want to put that – you know, but I guess with Rand Paul, I guess it remains to be seen because there does seem to be a lot of differing opinions about him.
Yeah, and that's true. I think that's the problem with Rand Paul is he's a tag. You know, you see some good stuff.
Oh, you're breaking. You know, your mic was breaking up really bad there.
Oh, okay, maybe I need to get a little bit closer. I think that's the problem with Rand Paul is that he's a mixed bag. You know, he's got some great points out there.
There you go. Yeah, it's still breaking up a little bit.
Okay. Well, Not sure why, and I don't know if I can get it cleaned up here in the next few minutes.
Oh, well, there you go. That sounds a little better.
Is that better? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with Rand Paul, I think, as I was trying to say, is I think he's a mixed bag. I mean, he's got, you know, in his speech, he had, you know, he uses the terms of liberty and, you know, talks about cutting back on certain things. I haven't seen his 5-year plan, but, you know, you know, and then you see where he goes off the beaten path. So, like I said, I think he's probably one of the better senators out there, but there's still problems of being part of the machinery, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some, you know, say, you know, nobody's perfect. You know, I mean, you know, someone messaged, you know, me, said, oh, well, you know, nobody's perfect. I said, well, yeah, I mean, I, you know, no one's perfect. But, I mean, as I said, the jury's still out with Rand Paul. But, you know, speaking of moving forward, is there any talk within, and maybe you mentioned this in one of the other shows, and if so, direct folks to the archives so they can hear it on your show. But when is you guys looking at anyone in particular for 2014 or 2016?
Well, actually, I never got to it on my show previously. I was really going to start kind of get Darrell Castle nailed down. The rumor is that Darrell Castle, the 2008 vice presidential candidate, is looking to make a strong run for the presidency in 2016. And, of course, Robbie Wells is out there doing his own thing right now. But
he's indicated, I heard a little bit about that.
Yeah, and he's trying to indicate, or at least intimate, that he would consider running as a Constitution Party candidate. You know, I think it's kind of, you know, he's playing the free agency out there is what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not very big on free agency, not right now, not when we really need a significant amount of help to build the party to a point where if he really wanted to win a race within the Constitution Party, we've got a lot of work to do to build it, and we need people here in the party building it, not simply building their own campaign. So, you know, there's kind of a mixed bag there, too.
Well, we're also talking about House members and Senate members, you know, for, like, 2014.
Yeah, well, I haven't made it official yet, but I'm looking to announce a race of my own for the U.S. Senate in 2014. We've got several that are running for state rep here in Illinois. And right now, kind of throughout the party, we're looking nationally. We're trying to really focus on some states that you know, have ballot access and can really focus in on some folks that might actually have an opportunity to win races. And I know Ohio has some folks that looks that they've been kind of seeking out the party, and there's some good name recognition out there. And so I know that Don Schrader is he's in communication with some folks over there. So there's some pretty exciting things going on around the nation in that particular regard. And over the next few months, we'll see how that pans out. And, of course, we'll probably get to notice some of these come April, because on April the 19th in Baltimore, we'll be holding our national committee meeting there, where we'll be heading and, of course, getting to meet some of these folks.
Well, great. Yeah, I need to look him up and give him a call. I'd like to have him, you know, come on. Or if you talk to him anytime in the near future, just, you know, tell him I'd like to get over with him, get in touch with him to talk about that. Definitely, I'd like to, you know, keep posted on what's going on, and, you know, have him on the show to talk about it.
Yeah, and Chris had out there on the thing asked if the CP has people to replace them all, and we don't yet, but we are looking and trying to recruit more. I'm not sure where we would be standing on the number of senators. He says there's 34 senators that are up for election in 2014, and, of course, one of those is Dick Durbin here in the state of Illinois. And but I don't have that number, but I'm hoping that in April, we'll have some kind of an idea where we stand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And then I guess you'll be looking for different kind of ways of funding the campaigns.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, and that's one thing that we have got to get better at, and one of the things that I'm hoping that we can really start focusing our attention on, and that's really teaching people how to raise money. You know, when you look at the races, like, for instance, in the Republican Party, you know, obviously you have to note that it's not the Republican Party that's raising the money so much. It's the individual candidates. And so we've really got to focus our attention on helping candidates to be able to raise money. And, you know, of course, a part of that is really helping not only the candidates, but people to understand the viability of their races. You know, one of the problems we have, it's inherent in, you know, the third party system, is we've got a lot of people who come here as refugees to the party. And by that, I mean, you know, they leave the Republican Party because they can't stand it. Not so much they don't come to the Constitution Party because they want to come to the land of the free and the home of the brave kind of thing, where we've seen that, you know, immigrants from other countries come to the United States. They come to the party because they're forced out of their country and they have no other place to go. And so there's not this real deep abiding sense that they are part of something greater than themselves, that they have the opportunity to win. A lot of times they run just because they don't know what else to do. And so we've got to really change the paradigm in people's minds about why they run within the Constitution Party, and to run to win and not simply run to make a statement. We get a lot of people from the Republican Party who come to the Constitution Party, run for a race just to simply make a statement, kind of to poke the voting in their eye, so to speak. And so we've got to get out of that mentality, and we've got to step up to the idea that we are here to win races and to make a change and make a difference. Otherwise, you know, I don't give our country a lot of hope for too many more years hence.
Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned to yourself and FW that, you know, about Mark Willis, I think he would make, and of course, for the Republican Party, but as well as for the Constitution Party, I think he'd make a great addition. And I think it's folks like Mark Willis who, frankly, in my opinion, the Constitution Party needs to have, you know, to help them build the party, for one, of course, with name recognition, too. He's obviously got conservative ideals and definitely willing to fight, even if it's against odds, you know, of course, going up against Rince Priebus, you know, to fight for that. I mean, yeah, I mean, it was just a debacle what they did to Mark, you know, for that, so.
Right. And you know, he brings up the point that, and it's kind of like I have been told personally to my face, Randy, we need the Constitution Party and we need you to build it. And they tell me, but Randy, while we need the party and I'm looking for you to build it and I'm rooting for you, I'm not going to help you do that. And you know,
none of that stuff ever makes sense to me.
Yeah, I know.
It's like someone saying, I'm against abortion, but I won't do anything to fight against it.
Yeah, but you certainly hear people say that.
Yes.
You know, they say, well, I'm not for abortion, but I think everybody has a right to make their own decision.
Right.
You know, and it's an insane position. And so, you know, yeah, absolutely. We need people like Mark. But at some point in time, we've got, you know, it's kind of like the old Field of Dreams. Build it, they will come. We got to start winning elections, and that's absolutely correct. We have to do that, and until we do, people are not going to, you know, be so inclined to come our direction. I mean, you know, let's face it. I understand. They don't want to jump to a ship, you know, from one sinking ship to another. You know, or to, in this case, maybe it's jumping from their ship onto a raft where you get too many people and it's just going to flow over and you're getting anywhere and everybody's going to drown anyway. So, you know, we've got to start demonstrating success. Absolutely. We need people like Mark to help us do so. We're recruiting. And folks, now is the time. If you have ever thought about running for an office, now is the time to do so. And more and more people are starting to see this. We've got we had a person on our call last night, not last night, Monday night. We hold a state conference call, Constitution Party state conference call, and we had a new person come and join us on that call. We've never heard of him before, but he's like, you know, I'm tired of the Republican Party, and I'm going to run my race. Now, it's a local race, and I think the guy's going to win. So more and more every day we're hearing more about this.
Well, indeed, and, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but, you know, and having folks, you know, like Mark Willis, those with the name recognition, those who are known to be fighters, to come on board. And I mean, and I understand, I appreciate his loyalty to the Republican Party, you know, and trying to fix it. I mean, I've been a Republican most of my life up until this last primary. Now I consider myself more of an independent, you know, because, I mean, this last election, I mean, you know, I voted for Constitution Party, maybe one Republican, some a Libertarian and a Green Party candidate, you know, so there was no down the party ticket for me this time around, because I had the opportunity of being able to vote for people from multiple parties in the local elections here where I'm at. So, you know, I was glad to have that opportunity, but, you know.
The point is, Robert, that unless we get good, credible candidates, you won't have candidates like that to vote for. It's a catch-22. And so, you know, we've really got to get people to understand that now is the time to do this and to really focus. And so, you know, I'm doing my hardest out there to recruit people and help them understand that now's the time to run for the race and to run to win.
Who would be the some of those folks that you would like to see come over? Now, I know you there's definitely some, you definitely have some issues with you know, a lot of the Republicans, and I understand why. But are there any there that you would like to bring aboard that, you know, you're like, okay, well, they're definitely fighting for conservatism, you know, and for the grassroots. Who would you like to, who would you think you'd like to bring aboard?
That's a real hard question for me to answer, and I'll tell you why it's a hard question. It's because I am not one that believes that we should seek outside the party for candidates, so to speak, like big names. Because, I mean, let's take a look at what happened in Colorado, for instance, Tom Tancredo. Now, Tom Tancredo is a person that, you know, I think was a pretty good person, you know, in terms of, you know, his positions and that sort of stuff. And they brought him on board there in Colorado. Well, he didn't win, and what did he do? He went right back to the Republican Party. And so, you know, what I tell most people is like, look, you know, if you believe in our principles, why aren't you here already? And so to say I'd go out there, you know, and say, who would I like? That's a real tough question, because if you don't have – and excuse me for saying it this way – but if you don't have the brains to be here already, I'm not so sure I want you here. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily that you're looking for, you know, names or someone from a particular party to join with the Constitution Party. But, you know, if the grassroots folks who, you know, who are maybe not been in politics before coming to the party, you talk about something like that?
That's the person I would love to have come and seek us out and to run with us, is a person that, I mean, look, I retired out of the Marine Corps in April of 2003. Within a few months, I discovered the betrayal of both the Republicans and the Democrats. So in October, I got familiar with the Constitution Party of 2003. January of 2004, I became the vice chairman of the Constitution Party here in Illinois. And I have never looked back. And then I became chairman of the party in January of 2005. In 2006, I ran for governor. And this is the way I describe it, as a nobody from Nowheresville that nobody knew, I still broke smashed the record for write-ins here in Illinois with nearly 20,000 officially recorded votes as a write-in candidate for governor. I want to see our citizens, there's a word Obama used, I want to see our citizens, our common Joes, I want to see them step up to the plate. I'm tired of the career politicians. I'm tired of those who, you know, look like they know what they're doing and still shove it out the door on us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want common man to step up. This is what our founding fathers designed. Those are the type
That's
of people
true.
I want to see come and step up to the plate. And those are the ones I'm encouraging.
Yeah, it's true. And any more, while I'm thinking about it, I know you're the young constitutionalists that Joshua Favre's working on. How's that going?
It kind of got stymied. There was an issue where we had to create a constitution for that group, and I needed to participate in that a little bit more, and I got sidetracked. So, and he's gotten a little bit sidetracked with the Robbie Wells campaign and that sort of stuff.
Well, did you work with that, or?
Well, he is the coordinator, the state coordinator for his campaign.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there's some work we need to do there and start getting that on board. It's just I got somewhat sidetracked with this, all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Robbie Wells came on the show one time before, and perhaps I need to get a hold of him again at some point, you know, find some contact information and see some kind of updates and see what's really on his mind. I know when here last he talked about, you know, building a coalition, a kind of a coalition of conservatives, I guess, which consisted of independents, Tea Party, true conservative Republicans, Constitution folks, and trying to build a you know, coalition of those kind of folks under the same banner, I guess, with him at the head of, you know, running for president for 2016. So,
yeah, that seems to be it. And then, of course, there's other efforts out there that are looking to build other coalitions or mergers and that sort of thing. And so
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of that going on out there.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, is it going to take do you think it's going to take a coalition that, you know, to pretty much replace the Republican Party, or is the Republican Party going to be a part of that coalition to be able to beat the liberals, or what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that need to be done, and part of that, certainly, you know, let's face it. You know, third parties, you know, when we split the votes on the minuscule amount of votes that we get, it is, you know, there's always a discussion about having some big tent umbrella organization to combine the parties together so that we can have a coalition to go and fight against the two major party duopolies. And there certainly is.
Right.
Yeah, and there's certainly some valid points on that. And but the problem is how you unite all these dogs and cats together in such a way as to form this type of coalition, because each of these parties have their own niche little things that made them,
right,
you know, become their party anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a real tough thing. Now, what we need to do, and one of the things that we did here in Illinois, you know, when we didn't make it for the ballot, I endorsed Michael Labneau, who was pro-life libertarian for the U.S. Senate in 2010. So I think we need to get together as major organizations and start talking with each other about how we can, you know, unite on something. You know, I've mentioned on Tex and Rex before that the Green Party candidate for governor, Rich Whitney, back in 2006,
mm-hmm.
he invited me to his press conference and gave me, when I was running for governor as a Constitution Party, a person who's pretty much diametrically opposed and his opponent, he
right.
gave me access to his media and let me
announce. Not all Green Party people are bad.
No, you know, now, you know, certainly there are some issues that divide us.
But sure, sure.
But where we can unite, that's the problem. We haven't established the points of where we can unite. And that's where we need to have the discussion.
Yeah, well, in 2013 will be here before you know it.
Yeah. I don't know if you realize what you said, 2013.
I mean, 2014, 2013, it's already here. it must be getting late here in Ohio now. But, yeah, 2014 will be here before you know it. 2013's already, I can't believe we're already in February.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, if we're going to start having some successes and start, really hammering this out, then, you know, we're going to have to start having these discussions at a national level amongst these parties if we're going to do anything of any significance in that regard.
Right. No, I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. Well, I do see some folks, as I said, just want to listen to you and I who are on the switchboard. If you'd like to chime in, just, of course, feel free by pushing 1 on your phone dial. We do have about 20 minutes left of recording time. Of course, you know, 15 minutes left of conversation, and then, you know, I'd like to end out to take the last 5 minutes to end out the show. Or if we've exhausted ourselves, Randy, as sometimes we do, we can cut things now. So what's your thoughts?
Well, just a couple of things that, I really appreciate you having had, Virgil on as well as Mark.
Yeah, that
was
Lewis. Great.
And I thought there was a good – I was just going to say I thought there was a great conversation.
Oh, I think so. I think it was great to have you, Mark, and Virgil all talking. And I really appreciate you guys coming on. I know it's kind of short notice for all of you about, coming on tonight, but I really appreciate it. You guys spending, as much time as you did, and also spending more time than what you guys originally you thought you'd be able to. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. And, one of the things that, I was looking at, going back to the idea of the State of the Union, so much of what Obama had said is refutable. I mean, it's absolutely refutable. I mean, for instance, he said after years of, in fact, this was the first part of his speech in the first part of, I think within the first paragraph, he says, after years of grueling recession, our businesses have created over 6 million new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting about that is since January 2008, the employment age population has increased by 11.7 million people. Yet, there are 3 million fewer people employed today. Now, if it's created 6 million new jobs, how is it possible that you've got an increase of 11.7 million people and yet have 3 million fewer people employed today versus 2008? And, then they talk mm-hmm. about poverty. He was talking about the poverty and the wages.
Ending war. Yeah, and also ending poverty in the world. I believe you talked about that too.
Oh, well, yeah.
Bit.
Well, poverty here in the United States, and the way we're going to end poverty here in the United States is we're going to tax people more.
We're going to make everybody poor. Then there'll be no disparity.
Exactly. And how are we going to help the global poverty? Well, we're going to tax you more and send more money out to other countries, which
mm-hmm.
incidentally, typically doesn't get to feeding the people. It just goes to support the machinery of those countries, and it never goes to actually feed the impoverished in that. So, every single thing almost that he said was refutable, was lies. And that's what people don't understand. And then I heard, all those discussions of, people afterwards, it was the most wonderful speech I'd ever heard. Pelosi, I about puked hearing what Pelosi had to say. And it was just disgusting, you know. And so, and then, you know, Rubio's remarks, was, like Mark had said, was nothing more than just Republican banter. And so, you know, really, what did we get out of it? Just more here, we're going to screw you some more.
Right, right, and take more money. And I'm going to flip through my notes here, some of the things on that, see if I can find them, because I have, like, pages here of notes I took last night. Let me see if I can find that where he's talking about it. Talk about the budget, and he's talking about the automatic cuts and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Well,
and then, you know, how are we going to fix the educational system? Well, we're going to reward those who do well. So
right,
what does that mean? We're going to tax you more and give more of your money away.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's talking about high-quality preschools, working with states for quality preschool. And, of course, when they talk about, you know, investment, or, as you said, you know, giving money to the states that perform or that make those type of education, I guess, or high quality preschools or whatever, a priority, then they'll give them the funds. Well, we all know when the federal government gives us state funds, there's always strings attached.
Exactly.
So it's really not about them helping the states. It's about them finding yet another way to control them.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just, it's almost beyond bizarre to me how people just don't get that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's about, you know, because they're like, well, if you want to get these federal funds that we got from the states, and for they can funnel it back to you. So basically, if you want your own money back that you gave to the federal government through taxes, you have to do this. And if you don't do what we recommend that you should do for these high-quality preschools, for instance, then we're just not going to give you your money back.
Exactly. And it's such a farce. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, the state of Illinois has the lottery system here that's supposed to subsidize education. Well, if there's so much more money, billions and billions of dollars, going into the educational system here than ever before, and yet education's still going down and down and down. Illinois is not one of the top educational states in the union. It's one of the worst. And yet we've got all these, you know, we've got the Department of Education putting money into the educational system. We've got the lottery system putting money into the educational system. We've got property taxes that
right.
are supposed
yes,
to be paying
here.
For local educational
yep.
needs too. And yet I have to take my – when I put my kids in the public school, I've got to pay for books. I've got to pay for this, and I got to pay for that. Where's all the stinking money? Where's my free education, you know?
Right. Well, I know I send my daughter to a private school, and, you know, to there's, you know, tuition. I think that folks, I mean, it's just my personal thing, I guess, as I said, because, you know, I pay the tuition up for her school. But I think, yeah, I should get some kind of tax break. You know, because I'm paying for my daughter to go to school, and I'm paying for someone else's kid to go to school, you know.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of a pet peeve of mine, I guess I have to honestly say. And then when they talk about, well, parents should be able to, you know, be able to send their kids to schools anywhere. And I used to be a proponent of what they have here, and they may have, you know, in Illinois as well, is the school voucher program, where if a kid's in this failing school, that they'll give they'll give the parents, you know, a voucher to get for them to go to a private school. And two things, and I used to be for that, okay, you know, they send these, you know, private, usually Catholic schools, at least in my area, you know, let them get some money so that these Catholic schools could stay, you know, because they do have good education there at the schools, and they do actually, you know, teach some kind of discipline and morals, you know, at these schools, you know. So, I mean, my religious affiliation, and it's not Catholic, but I still send my daughter to Catholic school because of the discipline and the morals they teach there. But
you know, but for, you know, I used to, so I, as I said, I used to be for, you know, a school voucher system, but then I start seeing, you know, what happens to those schools. What, you know, and what I mean by that is, you know, when, and this is just my opinion, it might sound elitist, and I'm not that by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, but at least here, where I live, is that if a parent's going to sacrifice what they do so they get, you know, what they have to in order for their child to go to a private school, that also is indicative on how those children are going to behave in school. But what they do here is they mix, you know, these kids who parents really don't care about their child's education and mix them into the schools with parents who do care about their children's education. And all it does is cause a lot of havoc. It really does. And I hate to see that. And then the schools actually go down because then you have a lot of, you know, you just have a lot of trouble. I mean, you really do. And I just don't see where a good alternative, a good system is for that. No, I'm not saying that, you know, all children don't deserve they have good education. Of course, I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is they need to better those public school systems so that they're not failing. And I had a lady a while ago saying that the reason why she moved into the area was because the state gave her an $11,000 check for her daughter can go to a private high school here because the area's public high schools are failing. So I'm like, well, hey, I wouldn't mind getting an $11,000 a year raise, you know, just for moving into a certain neighborhood because that neighborhood school is failing.
Right.
You know, well, I just don't see where that's, I just don't see where that's right. I don't see, you know.
You know, here's the thing, and we talked about it before, you know, all of this needs to be thrown out to the free market. The free market works. You know, competition. Let me say it again. Competition is the answer to most of these ills. If they can't compete, they go away. And that's the free market system. You know, it purifies the system. And so even in the school system, you know, I know our founding fathers created a state level of education because they felt it was important for the citizens to be well educated so that they could participate in the civil government, not at the federal level, but certainly at the state level. John Adams created a constitution for Massachusetts that included a Department of Education, and the Thomas Jefferson, same thing. So our founding fathers believed in education and they provided for it at the state level. But, you know, we're at a point where the states are so corrupt with everything that, you know, the education is just waning because the money's going elsewhere, anywhere, but the but to education. And so at some point in time, you got to figure out that the state schools are not working, and to open them up to, you know, the free market and just get the states out of it.
Right. You know, and, excuse me, you know, in the federal government and in the states, and as I said, it's just a personal, you know, opinion of mine because, you know, I'm in this, in that situation, and, you know, I talk to a lot of my friends who they're, that their children do go to the public schools, and I actually don't, you know, live in an area where the public schools are bad. I just prefer, you know, because of discipline, for the, her to, you know, go to a, you know, the private Catholic school. But, you know, I just don't, you know, as I said, because I'm in, I, you know, I think, well, you know, why should I, you know, and it's personal responsibility, responsibility for your own, and I just, I guess it's a pet peeve of mine where I know that, you know, I'm paying for my child's education, but I'm also paying for someone else's. You know, and yep. I guess I'm like, that kind of, you know, it just bothers me some.
And I think it should. I think that's an extremely legitimate concern because not only are you paying for a good education for your child, you're paying for a poor education for somebody else's.
Right, right. That's a very good point.
You're not, and you're not even getting your money's worth paying for somebody else's. So, you know,
right.
I think that that's problematic.
True.
And we don't have vouchers here in the state of Illinois. I would support that to where, you know, the value is that you can take your kid to, you know, public, chartered, or private school.
Well, they wouldn't send them to private schools. I mean, not private. They wouldn't send them to public schools around here because, I mean, the difference between the public schools here, especially in the city where I'm at, the difference between the public schools and the city, well, I live in a township, but we're like inside, you know, a bigger metropolitan area. But, yeah, the city schools are terrible. They really are. You know, so the public schools in the area are, I mean, the difference between them and the private schools is just immense. It really is. And the quality of education and discipline that's ferreted out in the system here is it's unbelievable.
You know,
go ahead.
Oh, no, if you got somebody else want to come on.
Oh, no, it's just me. And I do see we only got about 9 minutes left of even recording time. I usually like to save the last 5 minutes for closing. So I'd say we've got another 4 minutes, and then I better close some things out.
Okay. Yeah, well,
so
just kind of closing on the educational idea. You know, I took my daughter up to Olivet Nazarene University. It's a private school, private college. It's our the Church of the Nazarenes denominational school, and we've got several of them throughout the nation. And here in the state of Illinois, where education is one of the, you know, the almost the worst, and our schools are constantly, you know, begging for more money. And, of course, part of that is the unfunded deficit of teachers' salaries and retirements. But Olivet Nazarene University, a private school, runs in the black. And it doesn't get the same state funding that, you know, or federal funding that all the other colleges. So if a private school that has to go out and solicit funds from, you know, people specifically within the denomination and other places, if they can run in the black, why cannot the rest of higher education run in the black with all of the money that's supposed to be funneling out there? And that's just an example of how bad the system is.
Mm-hmm. Right. And for us, and they talk about us, you know, for the United States, when I mean us, competing globally, you know, they always talk about, you know, the education system. And, you know, it's not always about throwing money, you know, money at it and hope something finally sticks. I mean, I know that, you know, money is important. However, you know, when you're throwing good money after bad, then you're just not improving the system. You're just, you know, wasting a lot of money. You know, so do we need education reform? Yes. Do I believe in part of education reform is to, you know, possibly get rid of the federal level, like get rid of the federal Department of Education? I think that definitely needs a serious looking at and possibility of having that be one of the, you know, one of the things that are, you know, finally taken away, you know, at least on the federal level. And I know Newt Gingrich was, you know, talked about that as well. So getting rid of the at least the federal Department of Education.
Right. So that's, you know, that's pretty much, you know, the State of the Union farcical, you know, for most part, the Republican response farcical. And, you know, we're you know, it's kind of like that old song. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. You know, clowns to the left of me, clowns to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. And that's the way I not so much that you're a clown, but and not that it's a bad thing being stuck with you. But, you know, it's the idea that, you know, nothing is, I mean, we're it's like look left or look right. We're screwed.
Well, the only thing that could change that, and, you know, I tell my daughter this, is the only, you know, it starts with the individual, and the only way that's going to change is if we change, you know, some of the things, what we do, and part of that is to be more, you know, be more active, be more aware, and do more research.
But at this time, Randy, I'd like to thank you for coming in and getting ready to close things out. Thank you for staying as long as you did and coming up to the show. And, of course, you're always welcome. And, of course, folks, check out Constitutionally Correct. Also, it's Constitutional Party Radio. Is that it, Randy?
It's on my Constitutionally Correct blog talk radio, but I dedicate Wednesday nights to Constitution Party Talk Radio.
There you go. Constitution Party Talk Radio. Okay, well, great. Well, and that's on Wednesdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, correct? Which is 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Central?
Affirmative.
Okay, great. Well, definitely, folks, check it out. Check out Randy's pages that you heard earlier, as well as those from Mark Willis. Check him out as well. And I'd like to thank everyone for coming and listening to the show tonight, whether you listen to just the live or also listen to the recording. And, of course, if you're on the archives, please listen to all of the show, because I believe all of it was important to hear. In the archives. So I'd like at this time to end the show as I do every night. And thank you all once again, of course, also those who were in chat. So I'll end this with a song by Aubrey Ashburn. Take care, have a good night, and look forward to seeing you again. Take care, Randy.
Good night.
Good night.